Boucher knocks another one down. He's got 38, but Chicago's going to run out the clock. So Toronto fights valiantly, but unable to get a win. The Chicago Bulls come to Tampa and get the victory. It's a final at Amalie Arena. Chicago 122, Toronto 113.
First pitch swinging, a little looper, and that's going to drop. That's going to get one run in. Here's the throw to the plate. Not in time, and David Fletcher with a two-run single, a little blooper in the center, and that's exactly the type of hitter he is. Puts the bat on the ball. Swing and a miss. Gurriel strikes out. Iglesias strikes out the side, and the Angels win the opener of this four-game series.
You got a gripe. You got a gripe about baseball players' uniforms. And the best example of your gripe is your guy. Your guy.
Randall is
awesome right now.
Well, awesome defensively. We don't just play one side of the ball on our Jays team, okay? What do you think this is? I got expectations.
Are you starting to get frustrated with Randall offensively? I'm going to have to go.
I am.
Check
That's
the box.
That's my boy Randall.
I'm going to have
yeah,
to go check the
two games in a row now. I know he's playing well defensively, made a huge catch. You didn't even think he'd come up with that ball. I was shocked he got there a little bit.
Which one? You're talking about essentially the game saver at the time, the Trout catch?
Yes. Diving for it. I mean, what was the probability of coming up with that catch? There's got to be some kind of fan graph probability to come up with that catch, and it's under 1%.
We can go check that out. I think as an outfielder, Ziggy, the hardest play is the line drive that's coming right at you. That thing, if you take a step in and it can sail over your head, if you don't commit on a ball like the one Trout hit, you're not going to get there. Grichuk committed and had to still fully lay out. I mean, that's a tie game late. Couple of runs score on that play if Randall Grichuk doesn't make the catch. I mean, it was awesome. It's too bad they end up losing the baseball game. There's a lot to get into from that game last night. But, man, George Springer's going to be out at least another week. Randall Grichuk doesn't have anybody missing him with the way he's playing center field and generally with his start. I know he was hitless again yesterday, but generally with his start to the season. But are you going to throw your gripe out there?
I'm good. I'm good. He wasn't pitching. The whole thing with the unbuttoned shirts, I don't know what the deal is. If you wear a t-shirt underneath, if you wear a t-shirt underneath, I'm okay. It's a little bit much. The Randall, like, how many buttons does he have undone? It feels like he's got three or four buttons
gotta
undone.
Gotta be the top two at least.
Okay, that's okay if you got the undershirt on, but the Tanner Roark, he doesn't wear. He's got his chest hair kind of puffing out. It's a little much for me. Yeah, Tanner Roark. I know he didn't pitch yesterday.
And you can almost see them as they're getting lit.
Yeah. So that's my one thing for me. Keep the buttons like that's I don't it's a little flashy for me. I don't maybe that's it, but
you like the more formal conservative look.
This is the major leagues, all right? But Randall, yeah, a couple big defensive plays, the big one against Trout. It's good. He's filling the hole in Springer's absence. And you can tell with this Jays team, and I don't know where you want to start, but it's the lack of offense right now, and I'm going to put it on Springer, the fact that he's not in the lineup. Once you get a guy like that back, then you can all kind of settle in. But you don't expect this team to go on some kind of run or the bats to come alive until he's back. Like, when he got injured and knew he wasn't going to start the season, okay, if it was just going to be the first series against the Yankees, I get it. But now that it's going to go on multiple weeks, I want to see this lineup with him in it. And until he gets healthy, I'm okay. I'm not happy about these stretches. And it's like we've said yesterday, it's been just a spotty offense. They can't seem to string together any kind of, you know, innings and get deep on pitchers. And that's what I feel this makeup of this Jays team needs to do. And until Springer comes back, he's the guy they signed this off season, giving all the money to him. And you can't really settle in until you get your best player back in. And it's starting to show in these games, a lot of these close ones. And that's another one last night. But yeah, Springer's offense, you know, that's what this team is missing. Just that presence in the lineup right now.
I think that's part of it. That's a fair point. I think the other thing is you've got a lot of young hitters, and that's what they are. And a lot of guys who have a tendency to be free swingers. And if you watched Griffin Canning, who started the game for the Angels last night, and he was hit and miss. He settled in after, the first or second inning, and then gave up a home run to Kevin Biggio in his final inning of work. But in between there, I don't think the Blue Jays had a base runner for about a 2.5, 3-inning stretch. And with those right-handed hitters who have a tendency to get out in front and lunge, all you got to do is throw them an off-the-plate breaking ball the first pitch of the at-bat. And they've shown a willingness to swing at that, offer at that, swing and miss. And a 1-0 count is far different than what it ends up being, an 0-1 count. You put the advantage in the hands of the pitcher. I think one of the frustrating things for me, it happened a lot in the two losses in Texas, maybe not quite as much last night, but generally speaking, the count seems to be 0-2 a lot, right? And that's got to do with the aggressive approach of this team. A lot of these individual hitters are aggressive guys. But if you are in two strike counts a lot, it's going to be advantage pitcher. And you can say that for Marcus Semien. You can say that for Bo Bichette. Teoscar Hernandez, when Teoscar gets going, it's something. But when Teoscar's not going, he's flailing. And that happened at the end of the series in Texas. It happened again at points last night. So they're kind of in a collective funk, yet they scored 5 runs. Thing is, I mean, I know Biggio hit the home run. Vladdy is carrying this team offensively. Like, Vladdy is en fuego right now, Ziggy. He's unbelievable, and he is hitting the crap out of the baseball, all the contact. And you tell me, I think he roped a double down the left field line in Texas. Name another hit Vladdy's had this year to the pull side. There may be one other. I'm not remembering it right now off the top of my head. Everything is to dead center or to right center field. This guy's approach is on, and he is absolutely crushing the baseball. It's something to watch, and it's something to be really excited about, because and there are 155 games left here. This guy could be in line for a really special season. I know it's a small sample size, too early to declare anything, but the way he looks, this could be a big, big year and his breakout year in the big leagues.
Yeah, and he was good yesterday, and, you know, I'm still not sold on Vladdy. I think he's definitely made some changes, but just him at first base and him in this lineup right now, I need to see more. And like you said, it's a small sample size. I still need to see more done. I need to see more consistency with a bat through a longer stretch of games. I want to see him, you know, more games at first before I say, you know what, he's an all-star first baseman in this league.
That was a hell of a pick on the hitter. Hell of a pick on the Ohtani line drive at first base.
Absolutely.
He doesn't make that play last year.
No. But we've still seen some mistakes, foot off the bag, you know, deciding where to go. And I know a couple days ago he made a great play to third, which was the right call with the review. But I need to see more out of Vladdy. It's a great start to the season. But I think for young players, him, Bo, you throw Cavan in there, you have the honeymoon period where things are good, but until we get a couple more weeks into the season, I you know, come and talk to me after 20 games with Vlad. I love the start. I love what he's doing. He's better than expected, but especially with these young players, you want to see what happens when things don't go well. I feel like with a 162 game schedule, it's different than every other sport. A lot of this has to do with what happens when you're bad. What happens when you go cold? What happens when you're not, you know, you're just DH in some games? Can you still find your bat? That's what I think it comes down to. And as a young player in the major leagues, I feel like that's the biggest thing to kind of get over. Bo's found it. Cavan's found it somewhat. And Vladdy's that next guy that, you know, you want to see him, that progression, take that next step. And he's on the way. I'm not going to crown Vladdy right now saying this was the ceiling. This is where we saw him at. You know, he's not there yet for me.
But he is carrying them right now. And they need somebody doing something consistently. He's their only guy who I think has been consistent from opening day to now. And if he goes into a bit of a slump or cools down a little bit, that's when it's going to be time for one, two, or three others to step up. Another frustrating element of last night's game, Ziggy, it happened a couple of times. You got Joe Panik on second base. I want to say it was the seventh inning. Danny Jansen works a 3-1 count against reliever Tony Watson, and he gets the pitch to hit, and he doesn't do anything with it. He doesn't inside out it to hit it to the right side of the infield to get Panik to third base as the potential go-ahead run there with less than two outs. And he doesn't drive the baseball, and that was a pitch he could have driven. Ground ball to shortstop. Panik doesn't advance. Panik doesn't advance at all that inning. Boom. Inning is over. Then in the bottom of the 10th, you've held the Angels off the scoreboard. They extend Julian Merriweather into a second inning of work. He works the 9th and the 10th. So he strands the runner on second base. Of course, in extra innings now, teams are starting with a runner on second, try to enhance and increase the likelihood of scoring, keep these games from going 15, 16 innings. You've got Alejandro Kirk on second base as the designated runner because his spot in the order made the final out of the bottom of the 9th inning, right? Jonathan Davis pinch running for Rowdy Tellez, who had pinch hit for Danny Jansen, gets picked off. So that's another little fundamental thing we can discuss. But Marcus Semien is up. You have got to get the runner over. And I'm sitting there watching, and I know it's 2021, and I know these guys swing the bats out of their shoes. Dude, you don't need to hit a home run to win the baseball game. It's a 5-5 game, and you've got a runner on second base. Get the guy to third with less than two outs. We'll take our chances with Kevin Biggio, and you got Bo Bichette there as a backup if Biggio can't get the job done. But if you get that runner to third, the number of ways you can score that run increase. With one out, i.e. less than two outs, a sacrifice fly could score him. A fly ball deep enough to the outfield. A wild pitch slash passed ball could score the winning run. Alejandro Kirk could rumble down the third baseline. Get those feet going, baby. There are different ways to score with a runner on third and more ways to score than with a runner on second. I thought fundamentally at times last night, the Blue Jays just didn't, they weren't willing to trade an out for the extra base in those few scenarios in the sport where you'd be willing to make that exchange.
Is that not, is that a numbers thing where it's don't bunt? Like, even if you get a guy like Jansen at the plate and he's hitting a buck whatever last year and this year, why is the bunt gone in baseball?
Well, the bunt is gone because Danny Jansen showed on opening day in the top of the 10th inning that he couldn't do it.
Yeah, but it feels like it's not just him. It feels like it's all of baseball. Like, what teams, when they get into extra innings, bunt and then try to sack fly? Who tries that? Like, is that old school baseball?
I mean,
like, that's what I want to watch.
Right. And I think that there's an argument to be made, especially if you're the home team and you have kept the visiting team off the scoreboard in the top half of that extra inning. Like, you win. If the runner on second base scores, you win. There's an argument to be made for trying to advance him, to sacrifice yourself to advance that runner to third, making the first out of the inning. The problem is so many of these relievers have 97, 98, 99 mile per hour fastballs. They got such gas They got such live arms, and they're just out there for an inning, maybe two innings, airing it out. They've got usually have a nasty complementary secondary pitch that is 10 to 15 miles per hour slower than their fastball with significant break on it. It's tough to make contact. And so I think that that's part of it too, that if you give up an out to get the guy to third, runner on third, one out, that next hitter strikes out, well, your odds of scoring go down considerably, runner on third, two outs. So I think it's a couple of things. What I just said, plus the fact that too many guys have just come up through the years playing the game and not learning how to bunt. Yeah. Danny Jansen can't bunt. We saw that last week.
You have to find a way. You have to find a way to get Panic over. You have to find a way to get Kurt over. They lost the game. Like, you can tell me, I don't know if you want to start with the Jonathan Davis pickoff at first. Like, how bad is that? Because that to me is just, you come in to pinch run. That can't happen. How do you get caught sleeping at first?
Well, I didn't see it, but Louis Rivera, the Blue Jays third base coach, thought Steve Cishek, the right-hander who picked off Jonathan Davis, was balking. And of course, if it's called a balk, then Davis just advances to second base. Here's what I think happened. I mean, Rowdy Tellez draws the walk. You're not leaving him at first base as the potential winning run right there with two outs. You need speed. What you're looking to do with Semien up and two outs, you might not be as inclined to do this if there were nobody out, because you got outs to work with.
Yeah.
But you're thinking Davis, Cishek knew it too. He was at the very least trying to keep Davis close. Davis is there to steal second base. He's there to steal second base because if he does it successfully and Semien puts the ball in play to the outfield and it dunks in front of Trout somebody, game's over. That's it, right? So he's there to steal second base. That was his one MO.
So you're okay. So you're just saying the odds are.
I'm not okay with the pickoff, but he was going, and that's why he got caught leaning. That's what happened.
You're okay getting picked off there because the benefits outweigh. If the inning's over, it's over. You're not the odds of you winning the game in that situation from first aren't, like, they go up drastically if he can get to second. I can make that case.
I'm not okay with the pickoff. I would be okay if he got thrown out trying to steal.
Yeah.
Right. You're trying to get to second base because at that point with two outs, Semien's got to put one into the gap for you to score from first.
Okay.
Right. So Davis on first, you need two hits to win unless you hit a home run.
Yeah.
Effectively.
I'm okay with that then. I just getting picked off in that situation. And then I mean in the bottom of the 10th, when you can't get the runner to third, I don't think you deserve to win the game. Like, that your runner in extras, you should get him to third. That should be the bare minimum for you. If you can't even advance him, the Jays don't deserve to win these close games. But that's where they lost the game for me, bottom of the 10th. So find a way to get it done. You have to find a way to get the guy over to third. I don't know I'm sure this is something every team practices every single day in training camp. Like, this isn't something new, right? This is something they've learned to play with at this point. Something has to be done there because these tight games, and the Angels have won a bunch of them this year. You have to find a way to win. These are the games they won last year. Ones they won. So, yeah, that's where they lost it for me was in the bottom of the 10th. You have to find a way to get the runner over and then go from there.
They're 3-4. Good thing is in baseball, Ziggy. Right back at it tonight, right? Right back at it tonight. So let's do a little math here. And Adam Stanley's going to join us in about an hour. We each have our foursomes. You, Hugh, Adam Stanley, and me. And Patrick Cantlay just took a crap for you. So I've got Patrick Reed, Dustin Johnson, Tony Finau, and Bryson DeChambeau in our little pool. Hugh and I right now are tied with 294 strokes, our four players. Reed, DJ, Finau, and Bryson for me combined for 294 strokes yesterday. Hugh has Rahm, Spieth, Berger, and Wolf. They combined for 294 strokes. Adam has Justin Thomas, Rory McIlroy. We got to talk about Rory's dad. Colin Morikawa and Corey Connors. So Adam, 295 strokes. You have Patrick Cantlay, who dropped a turd for you, which has screwed things for you just a little bit. He shot a 79, 7 over yesterday. You got Cameron Smith, Webb Simpson, Adam Scott. You're totaling 297 strokes through the Thursday round at Augusta National.
It's very early.
It's very
early. Remember what I said last year? Wasn't some player in the top five last year and they didn't finish in the top 20? I said, watch, they won't finish in the top 10.
Yeah.
Whoever was leading it. And I just said, watch.
And there's Justin Rose, right? Right back at the
top.
I'll
tell you this. I'll tell you this right now.
Yeah.
As long as it's supposed to rain a little bit in Augusta, as long as it doesn't rain, I will tell you, as long as it doesn't rain, I will tell you this. The winning score, I'm going to stick by my minus 10. I will stick by it even after a 7-under yesterday, Justin Rose. Trust me.
That we won't see double digits under par.
Yep, and I'm still going to take that. And if anybody wants to take that bet, give me something. I'll still take it. Minus 10 is still going to, as long as it doesn't rain. It's just supposed to rain a little bit, and that would really change the course. From my contacts down there that I talked to. Oh,
I like this.
I don't know what to say.
I don't know how else to bring this up. I prefer my people. My people sounds way more like my contacts. Your people tell you. What are your people telling you?
They said from November, when they played it in November 6 months ago to today, it's not even the same golf course. What Justin Rose did was a one-off. The greens are double cut even more. They're rolled and they really dried them out. Like when I'm watching yesterday, I'm probably three putting all of these greens, and you can mix in a 4 or 5 putt. Who was the player? He putted the ball into the river. He had an eagle putt.
Yeah.
And it's happened before. It happened to Tiger Woods.
And so many of
you're 15 feet and you put your ball into the river. Like
And so a lot of the pin placements too, Ziggy, were, you know, more or less along the edges. Like that course played tough. Yeah, so it was almost like they took note of November, and Augusta National pushed back yesterday.
Augusta in November, in the opening day, the field was 54 under par in day one. Do you have some kind of guess on what the total field was yesterday? So 54 under par in November. What would be your somewhat guess if you're there 54 under in day one a couple months ago?
Well, man, some guys had some butt rotten days, some gross days.
220 over par the field was from 54. That's a 274 stroke. So if you want to know how it was, and that's what my friend sent me. They're giving me a little bit of a update on the condition of the course and just threw that stat at me, which I was just like, holy heck, I didn't think it was that bad. So they sent that to me, and I mean, I had to double check those numbers because I was in shock. Yeah, the course is playing that much tougher. It would be great if they could mix in a little bit of wind, and if the rain holds off, it's going to be, guys are not even going to be shooting even par. I'm telling you right now, but Justin Rose did. It's a complete one-off yesterday. We're not going to see anybody with 7-under the rest of the way. The pins are going to get tougher. You know, guys are going to start feeling it. The pressure starts, you know, going into the weekend. It's going to get a lot more difficult for these guys. I will say, if I had to guess right now, I'll say Justin Rose doesn't finish in the top 10. I'll do the same thing I did in November. Whoever was in the one was leading the tournament. I think it was Paul Casey, right?
Yeah.
I think he was leading after day one. I said he wouldn't finish top 20.
Well, Justin Rose, I think three times in the 2000s was leading after Thursday. And once he finished tied for fourth, and then the other two, he fell right off the cliff.
You just can melt on this course, and I love it.
It's something. Adam Stanley will be along, and we'll mess with him a little bit. I mean, he's got 295 strokes, one behind Hugh and me in our little mini pool here, but he's the only foursome out of the four of us who did not have a player shoot par or better yesterday. So we'll have some fun at Adam Stanley's expense. He'll join us at about 7:10, and we'll break down round one of the Masters, look ahead to the weather today, and some of the pin placements and how the course may play similarly or differently today than it did yesterday. The Maple Leafs are back in action tomorrow night against the Ottawa Senators. The Raptors, horribly, badly undermanned, lose to the Chicago Bulls at home down in Tampa last night. Is that the death knell for the season? The math is not looking good, and we'll circle back to the Blue Jays. Rowdy Tellez has seen his playing time evaporate in the first week of the season. I've got another player whose playing time, I think, is in peril. I'll share that name, and we'll bounce that around. It's all ahead. Lead off. I get direct messages on Twitter too, Ziggy.
Uh-oh.
So I'm going to read the DM that I first got. We've gone back and forth here during the commercial break. I'm going to read the DM that I first got, and I want you to tell me if you know who it's from.
Okay.
Ziggy doesn't pay his debts. Don't bet him about the golf and Justin Rose. He still owes me $50 over Mitch Marner. Ask him.
Savvy for
Mark
sure.
Savard is up. If you were wondering, if you were saying to yourself, what's Mark Savard doing at 6:30 in the morning on a Friday, I can confirm for you that he is awake. He is very much awake early.
I want to know what his Masters picks were. That's what I'm curious about. Everybody's hiding today. Everybody is hiding today. It doesn't have Justin Rose.
I said we went back and forth. So I shot him a note back. He says Marner beat Braden Point in scoring, and I will double down that Rose finishes top eight. May as well double down. He doesn't pay anyway.
Well, what happened was there was some controversy on what was actually bet. I thought we were betting Swiss Chalet.
This was the Swiss Chalet bet.
I'm more than happy to take him to Swiss Chalet. I'm waiting. I'll send it to. I'll Uber Eats it. It'll be more than 50. It was the Swiss Chalet. The bet was.
We're in the middle of a shutdown right now, and you're. I'll take a buddy to a restaurant. I'll pay my debt right now. Nothing's open. No indoor dining. Perfect timing for you.
So he wants to take. He doesn't think he'll think. He thinks he'll finish top eight.
I'll
take that.
I think he's waving the white towel and just realizing. I'll double down. I'll triple down. I'll quadruple down, and it'll never matter because Ziggy will never pay up, even if he owes me. I think that's
always,
what he's saying.
Always pay. I'm a Lannister, buddy. We always pay.
We always pay. We're Lannisters. We always pay our debts. The thing that pisses us off is we always seem to have them. seem to have debts. That's the problem. By the way, Mark Savard just DMing me now. He said, please mention p91shop.com. p91shop.com. It's his site to help with concussion research. So well worth the mention this morning. Thank you, Savvy, for jumping in on the program this morning. Yeah. We like it. Text coming in to 590-590. You, of course, are you going to take a little bit of flack? You don't like the baseball uniforms when the players wear the top two buttons loose, the wide open chest. Like Tanner Roark is kind of Tony Soprano-ing it. I'm not going to deny that. There's some chest hair. The only thing that's missing is the gold chain. Let's see what he says. Ziggy likes his uniforms tucked into his Lululemon pants, so anything different is no good for him. Jesse from Woodbridge. I guess he's saying, why do you like? Why do you care about the two top buttons if you're willing to tuck a Zigamanis 93 Blue Jays jersey into your Lulus?
Pretty much that listener's trying to tell me to take care of my own. Take care of my own house first. Get your house in order before you start complaining about other people's places.
Yeah. Glass houses don't throw stones. Yeah. People who live in glass houses. Pierre and Maple, the lab rat. Remember, he texted us last week. Then earlier this week, his girlfriend said, hey, will you shout out Pierre, my boyfriend? He's working in the lab this morning. So he's sort of kind of answered the question. His lab work is a thesis which has to do with muscle function in cold at a cellular and molecular level. Okay.
All right.
So Pierre clearly doesn't have the brains for a future in sports talk radio. That's clear. He's going to just go with the proletariat over there and do a little cellular and molecular work on the human body function in freezing cold temperatures. Okay. Sure. Anyway, shout out to Pierre and Maple. Thanks for being a part of the show.
We just got a tweet. We need to talk about Romano coming in to the game with a runner on. It's a serious problem that can lead to late inning losses. This is a coaching problem. I mean, when did he come in? A runner on second yesterday?
Yeah, first? Romano came.
No, second.
Yeah, Romano.
Runner on second.
Yeah, Romano came into the inning. Trent Thornton with one out gave up was it an infield hit? Anyway, whatever it was, one out.
Yeah.
I believe it was single. I believe the runner advanced and then ultimately ended up scoring on a base hit.
Yeah. So is that a mistake? I mean, if Romano's going to develop into this.
That was a seventh inning.
Late reliever, closer role, you know, is he going to be that guy? Yeah, he's got to get better with runners on. I think that's a tough situation for any.
But what's the complaint?
Reliever.
What's the complaint that
I
you're
think
reading?
Saying,
why did Romano come in?
Yeah, Romano can't be brought into games with a runner on.
Well,
they don't want him coming into games.
Okay, well,
I'll
tell you what happened. Dexter Fowler was the one who reached base. He's the nine hitter. You're in the top of the seventh inning. You're going back to the top of the order where you've got Fletcher, Ohtani, and Trout. Would you rather, with a one-run lead at the time, it was 5-4 Blue Jays, with a one-run, forget the result, the fact that the tying run ended up scoring. Straight up, runner on first, one out, top of the seventh. Fletcher, who's a contact hitter, Ohtani and Trout, who are elite-level hitters. Mike Trout is the Mickey Mantle of this generation, literally. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that figuratively. I'm not being a hot take artist.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you there.
Mike Trout is Mickey Mantle this generation. Who do you want pitching? Trent Thornton or Jordan Romano? You want Jordan Romano pitching. Yeah. I don't have a problem with that. And if he shuts him down, nobody's complaining.
So they're saying that's a coaching problem. Can't bring Romano in those situations.
Well, who do you want?
Yeah, who else do you want? Yeah. So
who do you want?
Tweet us in.
Who do you want? Trent Thornton to stay in the game, and then Trent Thornton hangs a breaking ball, and Shohei Ohtani hits it to the restaurant that I used to like to eat at when I was down in Dunedin, and I can tell you that restaurant is a good couple hundred feet past the right field wall on the other side of the stadium.
444 yards.
How about Shohei Ohtani's swing? I injured my back watching it. I can't imagine what his back feels like. Man, that guy does not get cheated. He is full value.
He goes after it.
And he can hit a fastball. And Mike Trout, apparently if Ross Stripling didn't know it before, he knows it now. You can't throw a cookie fastball right down the plate to Mike Trout. Did you see how quickly that ball left the yard?
Oh, yeah. Didn't it go into some school or something, they said? It said it went into some elementary school.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And it's too bad that Mike Trout plays out in Anaheim because his home games start at 10 o'clock at night. It's too bad the Angels have stunk for the last half decade, because if Mike Trout, and I know we don't love the Yankees in these parts, but if Mike Trout was a Yankee or a Boston Red Sox, I mean, love it if he was a Toronto Blue Jay, but if he was playing for a team in the American League East in one of the bigger markets that typically make the playoffs year over year, we would talk about him far more than we already do. He's that good.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's 440 feet. His biggest home run of the season is 464. That is just crazy. Why are they so bad? How can you have the best player? How can you have the best player in the league and be this bad this many years in a row? And I was looking up the Angels stats. It's like the playoffs once in the last 11 years.
Right. They made it in 2014 and were swept in three straight in the division series by the eventual World Series finalist Royals. Royals didn't win that year. The Giants did. Royals won the next year after they beat the Jays. It's simply this. I think what happened with the Los Angeles Angels is that they had a young core of starting pitchers. The late Tyler Skaggs, who for the years prior to his passing had trouble staying healthy. They had a left-hander named Andrew Heaney, who had high upside, and they had a right-hander named Garrett Richards, who had high upside, and none of those guys stayed healthy. Then Jared Weaver, who by that point was their veteran, had gone from a guy who could throw a flaming fastball to essentially a junk baller. And he more or less fell off a cliff late in his career. So as Jared Weaver's career was coming to an end, those three upstart starting pitchers were supposed to take over, and they all got hurt and couldn't stay healthy. And so the Angels just have never had the pitching. And, of course, Houston was emerging as an elite team in the AL West. The Oakland A's, they do it on a – they're like Tampa Bay Rays West, right? They do it on a tight budget. Some years they're good. Some years they're not so good. But they're always consequential. Texas was a good team in the mid-2010s. We saw that here in Toronto, back-to-back playoff series, 15 and 16 with the Rangers. So the Angels just kind of got lost in the mix because they couldn't pitch in that division. They didn't have enough arms or enough healthy arms. I think that's what happened.
And I'm going to be scared about Trout this year because last year, not a good year, maybe his worst year of his career.
By his standards.
You know a guy like that hits 281 last year. You know when that happens, when you're one of the best of all time, you have a down year, look out the coming year. Because these guys, they don't care about the money. They don't care about the stats. They want to beat everybody. They want to be the best. And that's scary when you get a guy like Trout. Well, so down year last year, watch out for him this year.
And Joe Maddon is their second year manager and had all that success in Tampa Bay, won a World Series with the Cubs. He likes to bring the Penguins and the Moose into the clubhouse to change things up. He's got the disco ball hanging from the ceiling in the clubhouse, likes to change the vibe, do weird things. He's kind of a guru that way, or at least fancies himself that. So, I mean, his approach is unique and has had a lot of success. So I think they're going to be a consequential team in the AL West. The one thing they have to have is Shohei Ohtani staying healthy. Should be fun on Sunday. Ohtani's going to pitch.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, Ohtani's going to pitch, and if Maddon does it on Sunday like he's done it so far this year when Ohtani's pitched, Ohtani will also hit. So the LA Angels will not have a designated hitter for Sunday's game, and you can't just put a designated hitter into the game when you replace Ohtani. So the LA Angels, presuming that Joe Maddon does this, will have a National League lineup when they play.
I love it.
In Dunedin against the Blue Jays on Sunday.
Entertaining,
thank
for
you.
Sure.
If Ross, I mean, I can tell you right now.
If you had to go one
nerd's dream.
If you had to go one way or the other, do you want your pitchers hitting or you want the DH? If you had to do universal.
If I had no choice?
Yeah, you had to do one or the other, the whole league.
Because you know how I like it. I like it like it is now.
I know you love it the way it is, and I don't. I want a DH the whole league. I don't want my pitcher. Okay.
I agree with you. Oh, Hugh Burrell. My buddy Rhett Bollinger of MLB.com, who covers the Angels, is saying Shohei Ohtani has a blister, and that's going to delay his next start. So, okay.
Still
going to
DH, but he's not going to pitch.
Could he just take the day off DHing, too? That'd be nice. I mean,
you talked about his swing and didn't look that great in this first at bat.
Change ups, waving.
You can see he's on basically he's on his back heels as he's swinging the bat.
Yeah, but, I think he's geeked for 94, 95, and then if you can get him 82, 83 with a fading changeup, it gets him way out in front.
What a specimen that guy is. He's so quick too.
Yeah.
And he's not a small guy. He's a big guy.
Yeah. Got a pitcher's body though too. Yep. Just fun to watch. I'm just glad he's healthy. Blue Jays back in action tonight. It's a 7:07 first pitch in Dunedin here, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, a game you can watch on Sportsnet. William Nylander remains in COVID-19 protocol for the Maple Leafs. The Raptors had 8 players last night. Chris Boucher did what he could, but it wasn't enough. Are the Raptors done? They're 3 games back of the 10th place Bulls in the Eastern Conference after the loss to Chicago last night. We'll answer that question next. Had 8 men last night. Chris Boucher tried to be all of them. 38 points
off,
19 boards, but of course it wasn't enough. DeAndre Bembry was suspended last night for leaving the bench in that altercation essentially between OG Anunoby and the LA Lakers the other night. Fred VanVleet also got a 1-game suspension, but he was out with a hip injury last night. So he has to serve that suspension once he's healthy enough to play. And so the Raps were down to 8 guys. The Bulls beat them. They're now 3 games back with, 20 games to play. It's not looking good. If you want to argue, Ziggy, that the Bulls are a 500 team the rest of the way, and I understand they could be worse than a 500 team, but if they're a 500 team the rest of the way, the Raptors have to go 13-7 just to tie them, and the Bulls have the tiebreak. So yeah, it's not good.
That was a big one. That was not a big one yesterday. Yeah. Big one yesterday. Tough lineup. Boucher, though, great game. That's happy to see him develop into that role. The only thing is these one-offs from him are, if he wants to get to the place where we need him to get to, these can't just be one-offs. They have to be every night. And I know he's not going to score. You know, he's not going to get 38 every night. You know, he's not going to pick up 19. That's almost 20 rebounds in a game is a lot. But he's protecting the rim well yesterday. Good on the glass. And yeah, he was shooting from spots yesterday that you never usually see him shoot from. So expand his range, mixing in some different shots. But he needs some help. And with 8 players, you're not going to get that done. Gary Trent Jr. and Malachi Flynn were 5 for 25. It's just, it was a bad night offensively for a lot of guys, limited lineup. And that was a big one for them. And I just, at this point now, would you say 13-7? Yeah,
it's about what they need if the Bulls are a 500 team the rest of the way.
Here's the thing. Do you want them to be competitive or do you want them to tank and get a higher lottery pick? That's kind of what it's going to come down to.
Yeah. And it could just be that they're not good enough. I mean, with that lineup, they're not good enough. No Kyle, no Freddie, on and on it goes. You want those guys going out there and competing and mm-hmm. you don't want some sort of acceptance of losing culture seeping in. I don't think there's any worry about that with the Raptors, but if they happen to play hard and lose, I think that's probably the best result at this point. Adam Stanley will jump in about 10 minutes time. We'll get Hugh in and we'll go over our Masters picks, how everybody fared on day one at Augusta National and potential changes to the course today. Could the weather be a factor? Shai Davidi on the state of the Blue Jays, including his back and forth on Zoom yesterday with the manager, Charlie Montoyo. These Blue Jays players been vaccinated or not? The New York Yankees, Aaron Boone, their manager, announcing a couple of days ago that the Yankees had been vaccinated. 3 days to the NHL trade deadline. It's Monday. Elliot Friedman on the very latest. Tim Leeper and the USA Today's Christine Brennan all ahead on the program. Stay with us. Ziggy, you got to lean into your bets and commit to your bets the way Michael Conforto of the New York Mets leans into a strike, leans into a curveball and gets dinged on the elbow. Bases even loaded, hit by pitch. Mets walk off the Marlins.
Even the Mets broadcast was like, what the heck was that?
You know who's on the Mets broadcast. I don't even think I'm going to get home to my house tonight.
No, but I'll get his
tits lit. Oh, that's Keith Hernandez.
I'm serious, though. They were just like, is that a joke? Like, one, did it even hit him?
Yes, it did.
I watched this. He leaned into it, though.
Yeah. He leaned into it.
It was over the plate. Strike.
Yes.
How was that possible? Here's the thing for me is it not reviewable? Because apparently the rule book, you can't go back and review that play.
Correct.
Like, so is that what they were checking then? Or did they actually check it and say,
because he called the strike first, right? And you can't review balls.
He brought up he was going to ring Conforto up, and then he changed his call. You can't use video review. You are allowed to call all three umpires or the third base umpire in and have a little confab. What did you see? And then try to make the appropriate decision based off of that conversation. The umpires can do that.
Yeah.
But what they can't do is request a review from the video room in downtown New York.
Yeah.
Like the league can't review that play
and post-game,
on the spot.
The ump apparently admitted that it was the wrong call.
But if you have video review, it's four plays like that. That's what I don't get it. You're slowing the game down, whether it's baseball, hockey, like you have to be. Remember the whole thing with hockey? You couldn't review certain plays at certain times and it had to be the exact. And then they changed it this year where they've opened up what you can actually review. And if you still have to make the right call on what you want to look at, but you have more options, which is why the whole purpose of having, you know, the review in place and the rules. So I just, when you have a situation like last night, that's a perfect example of you're slowing the game down enough with all the reviews. How can you not look at that in such an important part of the game and get it wrong? You want to get things right with video review, and they didn't.
But the thing is that call was a subjective call. Out safe at first base is an objective call.
Yeah.
We saw a very close call in the top of the 9th or 10th inning, the Julian Merriweather, where he kind of fiddled with the infield grounder there. It was a bang-bang play at first base. Whether the runner was out or safe, the call on the field was out. And so then it's an objective safer out call. If there's no concrete evidence to overturn the call on the field, the call stands, which is what happened in the Blue Jays game last night. Is it obvious to the three of us and to most others that Michael Conforto clearly leaned out over the plate with his elbow guard and was nicked by that pitch? Yes. But that is a ball strike. That sort of call is subjective. And I think that would be baseball's argument for not wanting to set a precedent. We will review objective calls. We don't all of a sudden want the subjectivity of our umpires.
Can you imagine if they started reviewing balls and strikes?
Well, you can't do that. I mean,
exactly.
The next step would be the robot umpires as opposed to doing that. I mean, the game would never end.
So why would you not just lunge across the plate? You have the bases loaded, bottom of the 9th or the 10th. Just jump in front of the ball.
You can't do that.
The bottom line is the umpire screwed up. There is a rule in the rule book which states you cannot,
Make a movement to get out of the way.
Right, have to make a movement to get out of the way. And I'm not even talking about for a pitch that's over the plate that you lean into. If a guy throws a 72-mile-an-hour curveball and you can clearly see that it's coming at you and you just stand there like a statue and it hits you in the side, the umpire is within his right. It doesn't often happen.
Never happens.
But is within his right to say, you didn't try to get out of the way. That pitch is a ball. You don't get first base. It's ball one, ball two, whatever it is. So that rule exists, and that is the rule that the umpire should have enforced on that particular pitch.
So the at-bat would have continued.
Or it's strike three.
Yeah.
He leaned into the strike zone.
Yeah.
He leaned it. Getting hit by the pitch doesn't make the pitch a ball. That was a curveball that in my assessment,
going to be a strike, yep.
Cut the inner half of the plate. It was going to be a strike. You're out. On to the next inning. I think there were two outs, right? It was a walk-off hit by pitch for the Mets.
That
would have ended the inning.
Yeah.
And the game would have rolled over to the top of the next inning for Miami. It's
boy, the Marlins better not miss the playoffs by a game.
Well, they're the Miami Marlins.
Playoffs?
They might miss the playoffs by 20 games. I know they had to come up a little
World
bit.
Series champions.
They had to come up a little bit last year. But
this Conforto, he said that from my point of view, it was a slider. It felt like it was coming back to me. I turned. I don't know.
Yeah. No, he did not.
I don't know. There may right have been. It. Hold on. There may have been a little.
The lie detector test determined that was a lie.
Yeah. Yeah.
There. And then he continues. There may have been a little lift to my elbow just out of a habit, out of reaction, and it barely skimmed the edge of my elbow guard.
Oh yeah. And Shin Soo Chu just magically just left his bat out there when Russell Martin tried to throw that baseball back to Aaron Sanchez in the seventh inning of the 2015 Game 5 Division Series, right? Yeah. That's a habit. I just
I do it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Born at night, night.
Good for Conforto. He got away with it. The Mets won the baseball game. The league screwed it up. The umpiring crew, particularly the home plate umpire, but the league screwed it up. I mean, there's no question about that. Doesn't mean anything to the Marlins now. They get another L hung on them, and they're off to a slow start this year. Leafs and Senators tomorrow night. The Raptors lose to the Bulls. Badly undermanned last night. Now three games back, and the Bulls have the tiebreaker for that 10th and final playoff spot, if you want to call it that. The play-in tournament in the Eastern Conference, and the Blue Jays fall to the Angels 7-5. This is the 9th home opener out of their last 10 that the Blue Jays have lost. That's really meaningless in the grand scheme of things, because 10 home openers ago, there were no current Blue Jays on that team. But it still nonetheless is tough. They're on a 3-game losing streak, and they've got to get it. They got to get it back. You don't want this to turn into a 5 or 6 gamer really early in the season. And you got 3 more with the Angels and then 3 at home with the Yankees. It ain't getting easier. It ain't getting easier here.
No. Why aren't they hitting?
They're not patient enough.
Yeah. It's a very simple question.
Vladdy's hitting. Yeah. Grichik more than not.
He'd hit more if he'd button up his jersey. I'm just saying. I agree with Ziggy.
Hitting.
That's what it is.
But there's just not enough consistency right now. You know, Rowdy Tellez, I said this last hour, I want to bring this up, and then Adam Stanley will join us. And we will get Shai Davidi's feedback on this. I think the Blue Jays, if they're not close, they should be close to flipping the script on their catching. Danny Jansen just has not shown the ability to hit. And I would argue that he become Hyunjin Ryu's personal catcher, and that he play the day games after night games. So he catches Ryu, and he catches the day games after night games. If Ryu pitches a night game and the next day is a day game, then Jansen plays the Ryu game. And
you have that much faith in Alejandro Kirk?
Well, I think Alejandro. Well, I want to see if Alejandro Kirk's bat can play at this level on a consistent basis. He had a very nice 2 weeks at the end of last season. He's obviously the backup catcher, just had a bit part so far this year. He's hit in spring training the last couple of Grapefruit Leagues. We got to see what we have here. Danny Jansen can't hit. I know he hit in the minor leagues. I know he hit coming up. I'm not seeing it here in the big leagues. Rowdy Tellez has already had his playing time cut into. The Jansen issues offensively stretch back 2 calendar years now. I'm not saying Danny Jansen's not a big leaguer and that working with the pitchers, playing well defensively, isn't a crucial aspect to catching. But there's just nothing in that bat, and I think Alejandro Kirk is deserving of more playing time.
Yeah, get him in there. I want to see Kirk. I want to see more of him. Let's have him play some more games. Let's see what he's got. I just at this point, Danny Jansen, I don't know. He didn't have a great year last year. He's gotten off to a slow start. The issue is can Alejandro, what's his defense like? I think his arm's good enough to pick guys off at, you know, catch guys stealing, but it's one of those things where what's good enough defensively for Alejandro Kirk? Like, what do you need to see out of him till he's a regular behind the plate? I think that's what the question is going to be right now.
Yeah, just with the team not hitting in general, and Jansen is just, and it's not just that he's not hitting. It's when you're not hitting, you're a nine-hole hitter, you don't have a lot of pop, and fundamentally, I mean, he didn't get the runner over with the bunt on opening day, ended up striking out, doesn't get the runner over last night in the same situation in the extra inning there. Like, it's just generally frustrating.
I'm not so, yeah. I just, for me, it's not that. For me, it's the bullpen, how many guys you're going to use. If they're going to use six players out of the bullpen, that's concerning for me for most nights. I don't, because when you get six guys in there, you can't have six relievers come in and pitch a perfect night. One or two of those guys aren't going to have it, and that's what's going to hurt you. When you get to, let's keep track of how many times they get six guys out of the bullpen and see where they're at. I don't think they're going to win many games.
We got some breaking news. The Prince, yeah. Philip.
Yes, the Duke of Edinburgh.
The Duke of Edinburgh, Queen Elizabeth's husband, has passed away. So he is...
the age of 99.
He was a couple of months shy of his 100th birthday. Yeah. I think he was turning 100 in the next couple of months. He hadn't been well, in and out of hospital. I got to be honest, I haven't stayed on top of it, but there have been reports in and out of hospital over the last number of months. So, dude lived a long life, full life, man.
Yep.
Just a couple months shy of his 100th birthday. Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, passing away. Reports coming out of London, Buckingham Palace right now, dying at the age of 99. Adam Stanley's Masters Report is brought to you by RBC. A Masters champion must rely on his knowledge of the storied Augusta National to win. With 150 years of insight and expertise, RBC sees things differently. All right, let's do the stroke total here after the opening round at Augusta National. Yesterday, Adam, Hugh, Ziggy, and I each took a foursome of players.
Oof.
Adam had Justin Thomas, Rory McIlroy, Colin Morikawa, and the good Canadian kid, Corey Connors. 295 strokes on Thursday. Ziggy with Patrick Cantlay. 79. Cameron Smith, Webb Simpson, and Adam Scott. 297 strokes. Man, Cantlay stiffed you, Zig. Hugh had John Rahm. Or has John Rahm, Jordan Spieth, Berger, and Wolf for 294 strokes. I've got... I've got the NWO of golfers.
Oh, okay.
I got Patrick Reed, the ultimate heel. He shot a 70, 2 under. Bryson gave it all back and more. 76. DJ and Tony Finau, 2 over par. I got 294 strokes to my name. So Hugh and I are co-leaders after Thursday, which, Adam, we know means jack squat.
At least we were all pretty close, though. I got to say, none of us were really doing all that great, but we're all right there. It's going to be tight over the next couple days.
I think we should bring in a new I think we should be able to get rid of a player and bring someone new in. You can make a trade. I don't know if Scotty wants to think about this for a minute, but I think we should be allowed to drop one of our four and pick up a new player as part of our group. I don't know if you like that option or not.
I'm going to defer to our captain and let him decide.
Because that's pretty ugly. What did you make of?
I'm not even going there. Ziggy was big on Patrick. Your first round pick was Patrick Cantlay. I'm not off the hook with your first round pick.
I'm just okay. We don't have to do it then. I'm just throwing that option out there. Okay,
you're just mad because Mark Savard's calling you out. You're losing bets left, right, and center.
what did you make from the first day of action?
Yeah, I mean, obviously a couple of observations. You know, firstly, when I picked Rory yesterday, I was laughing almost in spite of myself because I was like, I'm going to hate this pick when he shoots 41 in his first nine on Thursday, and he shot 39, and I was like, oh, classic Rory. But I just can't quit him. And he also hit his own father with an errant approach shot at one point on Thursday. So I don't know what's happening with Rory. But Justin Rose, what a fascinating first day for him. I mean, this is a guy who withdrew from his last tournament about 5 weeks ago. He hasn't played a lot of golf on the PGA Tour. He hasn't played very well on the PGA Tour. He hasn't won in about 2-3 years. He's, you know, getting older, obviously, but he just ended up going back and working with Sean Foley, Canadian golf coach, obviously. And they've just kind of started working on things that got Justin Rose to number one in the world a couple years ago. And I think it was one of those days at Augusta National where it was playing firm, it was playing fast. It was just really, really hard. And someone's experience, the fact that Justin Rose has led or co-led after the first day at the Masters a bunch of times before, he's been there late on Sunday. I think it was kind of the perfect setting for somebody like him with experience to go in there and play really, really good golf. And it definitely was surprising, but in the grand scheme of, okay, here's a guy who knows what he needs to do around Augusta National, it also wasn't all that surprising.
Adam, it's been about, oh, I don't know, 30 seconds since anyone's talked about Bryson DeChambeau. So so let's talk about Bryson DeChambeau. Watching him yesterday, you could see how frustrated he was getting. And listening to Sir Nick Faldo on the broadcast, you could hear how frustrated Faldo was with the way that DeChambeau was playing in terms of all the technical stuff and all the yardage numbers that he needed and gauging the wind and all that kind of thing. It looked like DeChambeau, obviously, he didn't have his irons dialed in. He was long on a lot of his approach shots. Should he go to playing more by feel, I guess? Because this looks like another disaster for DeChambeau.
This is the thing about Augusta National. I think Bryson DeChambeau approaches golf like it's a science experiment, but Augusta National is an art project. You can't apply your scientific learnings to a place like Augusta because it just doesn't work. I mean, last year, you know, Bryson played pretty poorly and then he had to go get all these tests. And it was like, no, man, you're okay. Augusta National just messed with your head and you weren't breathing right. You just didn't get enough oxygen. And the same thing seems to be happening right now. To your point, Hugh, about Nick Faldo, he just kept coming back to it. He was like, what is this guy doing with a brand new driver this week? What is this guy doing trying to, you know, solve this puzzle using scientific methods? You just have to go out and play it with feel. You just have to work your way around this golf course in a creative way. And there's no special formula that's going to work. You can't apply all of your other stuff to Augusta National. The golf course is just that tricky. So, you know, Nick Faldo didn't have a problem with Phil Mickelson putting two drivers in his bag because Phil called that out, you know, 3 months prior to the Masters when he did that. And it was like, this is my plan. But Bryson seemed to not have a plan this week. He was just trying to apply the thing that he does week in and week out to Augusta National. And here we are a second year in a row. And he just can't figure it out.
Adam Stanley is with us, brought to you by RBC. This is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
If you had to pick a guy from the field to, you know, climb to the top today, who would scare you the most if you're Justin Rose kind of sitting there at the top at minus seven? Who do you think's gonna pop up from that rest of that group at minus three through to even, I guess, even plus one from yesterday?
Yeah, you know, I think unignorably Jordan Spieth has to be on the top of that list. I just think that yes, he had a pretty interesting first day. He was in the trees, he was chipping in, he was doing this, that, and the next thing. But the fact that he was in red figures after day one has got to be a good confidence booster for him. So if Jordan Spieth shoots 68, something like that today, gets it to maybe 4 or 5 under par going into the weekend, I think he would be of concern. Sneaky Will Zalatoris, I think, as well. Will is playing with absolutely no fear, 2 under par, his Masters debut, you know, one of the best ball strikers out there. I think we talked about him as kind of a long shot pick early on in the week. So I think the fact that he has no scar tissue is going to be helpful. And this is a shout out to Scotty Mack and his heel squad. But I actually think Patrick Reed is probably one of those guys that as well could make a little noise today, you know, for all of the, you know, all of the things that surround him as a person. He's won at Augusta National before, and his short game is one of the best on the PGA Tour. And as these greens continue to be quick, as creativity, a premium needs to be placed on creativity, I do actually think Patrick Reed can make a little bit of noise today as well.
Yeah, if they keep making, if the setup is the same or tougher where it's been difficult to hold the greens, if this is a short game competition, I take Patrick Reed over anybody else in the world right now. You know what I mean? Like if they make the setup.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't love to say that, put it out there in the universe, but it's one of those things where like you can't deny how good he is around the greens.
Adam, we're up against it just a little bit, but we would be remiss if we didn't ask you about the Canadians yesterday. Mac Hughes, even. Corey Connors, plus one. Mike Weir, plus six. What do you think?
I spoke with Mackenzie Hughes' caddy yesterday after the round, and he just said, listen, Mackenzie did everything right. It was steady. It was solid. There's nothing really spectacular, but Mackenzie Hughes, another guy with a really, really good short game, and that was definitely on display yesterday. Mack Hughes' caddy, interestingly enough, told me the greens were running basically like a U.S. Open, firm, fast, and just incredibly difficult. Corey, just one bad hole for him, the par 5-13th. He hit the ball in the water with his approach. But otherwise, he told me he's feeling really good, comfortable, and has a lot of confidence into tomorrow. Mike Weir, tough day for him overall, just couldn't get things working in his favor. So he'll have some work to do to try to make the cut. But I like Corey to bounce back today, and I think if Mackenzie stays steady, maybe gets it into red figures, that'll be a nice day for him as well.
Well, Adam, I mean, I'm looking forward to breaking this all down, and we all are with you on Monday after the Masters is wrapped up, and I think it'll be a lovely image. You know, now that Patrick Reed's wife's AirPods have been confiscated. I can't wait for the group hug. Husband, wife, Patrick's parents, just everybody celebrating his second green jacket late on Sunday afternoon. Just togetherness. Togetherness. Warms the cockles of my heart. Thanks, pal. We'll talk on Monday.
Can't wait, guys. Have a nice weekend.
Adam Stanley's Masters Report brought to you by RBC. A Masters champion must rely on his knowledge of the storied Augusta National to win. With 150 years of insight and expertise, RBC sees things differently. Hugh is rocking back and forth to the Masters theme.
Can't get enough of this Adam Stanley. My goodness. You want to hear more Adam Stanley?
Tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. on The Golf Show, co-hosted by myself and Brent Gunning.
Season premiere.
Season premiere of The Golf Show tomorrow, 8 o'clock on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Six-day work week, Hugh.
Yeah.
Back.
Well,
they
backed a truckload of money up in my driveway. I couldn't say no.
They got you. They got you free passes to your favorite course, didn't they?
Where are all the golf passes?
Ziggy, I'll let you know when I get them. Believe me, I haven't seen them yet, but I'll let you know.
I can't wait for another five and a half hour round.
The breaking news this morning out of London, England. Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, Queen Elizabeth's husband, has passed away a couple of months shy of his 100th birthday. Shai Davidi coming up on the other side. Have the Blue Jays been vaccinated? And is Danny Jansen's playing time about to be cut? We'll get into that and more next. Elliot Friedman, Tim Leeper, Christine Brennan of USA Today, all ahead on the program. The Blue Jays lose 7-5 in 11 innings to the LA Angels last night. Back-and-forth game, an entertaining game, a winnable game. But they have now lost three in a row and will attempt to get back on the horse tonight to discuss the goings-on, including the George Springer injury situation. My soapbox this morning, the Danny Jansen playing time situation, and so much more. Here he is, Blue Jays insider, Sportsnet.ca baseball columnist, Shai Davidi. Hello, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen.
It is good to hear your voice. We appreciate you getting up to do this. I mean, if that had gone 13, 14, 15 innings, I would have had to permit you to pull the chute.
I mean,
we know how it is.
we're lucky that, I know a lot of baseball purists hate the rule about runners starting on second base in extra innings. But, I think the game has eliminated that, which has been terrific. Those games that drag on forever and ever. And, I've really come around on it. I was pretty skeptical, but yeah, it makes for fun baseball, and it gets the game done. You know, we shouldn't hate fun in baseball the way we do. And, you know, personally, I think it's fun.
No, I've totally come around. It's like 3-on-3 hockey in overtime. Like, you're probably going to see a game winning goal, which spares us the shootout. Here, you're probably going to see a run scored. And if you're a fan of the home team, if your team prevents the visiting team from scoring like the Blue Jays did in the top of the 10th inning last night, Shai, you're feeling really good about where you're at heading into the bottom of the 10th, especially with the top of the order coming up. Unfortunately, exactly. Fundamentals, baby. I'm on that get that guy over soapbox. I don't mean bunt, but I mean make sure he ends up on third base with one out at the very least. That's, you know.
I hear you on that one. And, you know, I think that, look, you've got the top of the lineup. You've got Marcus Semien in there, a veteran hitter who knows the situation. And, the first pitch, I believe it was, it takes a big swing. And it's like, okay, he's trying to win this year, which is okay. You want that too, right? But
you don't need a home run to win the game in that situation, though, right? I know these guys are trained to swing out of their butts, but, like, a Punch and Judy single will do it too.
You know, I think if you're in the bottom of the lineup, it's a lot easier to sort of take that mentality and move the guys over. But, you know, you're going 1-2-3 and, you know, Marcus Semien's been, an MVP caliber player. You know, are you really asking an MVP kind of caliber type of player to sort of move it along? You know, I think you kind of give him a couple shots to knock the run in. And then maybe with two strikes, you're trying to hit the ball to the right side. But you're right. I mean, that's where the game was won and lost. You know, there were some spots earlier in the game, and obviously Jordan Romano not being able to hold on Dexter Fowler in the seventh ended up playing big. But, you need to win the game there. You know, Julian Merriweather gives you a zero in the top of the 10th, and, you know, you've got to finish the job at that point. And, it's not like you're facing Raisel Iglesias either. You know, you got Junior Guerra there. You've got a guy who, you know, should be hittable. But give some credit to Guerra too. You know, I mean, he made a couple terrific pitches, especially on the full count pitch to Kevin Biggio. Slipping a fastball in there after just a steady diet of splits to that point. So, sometimes that's baseball too.
What do the Jays have to do to get the bats going? Like, is it something as simple as, okay, once Springer's back in the lineup, we'll see his presence and what he can do offensively, and then all of a sudden other players will feed off him? Or is there more deficiencies there that maybe we don't really see it, or we're starting to see as the season goes on?
They shouldn't be waiting for George Springer to be a panacea, right? I mean, even without him, this was it's basically the same team that they had last year, even better still because they've got Semien instead of Travis Shaw, which is a major upgrade. They just got some guys who aren't hitting right now. It was just, you know, going through some stats, their swing and miss right now is in the upper tiers of the major leagues. Their slug is really down. Those are a couple of areas that are going to correct a little bit. Maybe they have some guys who are a bit anxious right now. I think you can certainly see that in with certain guys, you know, maybe swinging out their shoe tops a little bit, and then maybe that accounts for some of the swing and miss. But you know, I mean, we're also a week into the season, right? And teams are going to have bad weeks, especially when you're just coming out of spring training. Everybody's shifting from, you know, Grapefruit League mode into regular season mode. And, you know, we saw the Blue Jays not hit for the first couple weeks of last season too, and then they mashed the hell out of the ball. So I think that as frustrating as the first week has been, you know, that they certainly left one game on the table in Texas and they left another one there last night. It is also, you know, what are we, six of 162 at this point. You know, there's still a long, long, long way to go.
With Shai Davidi on leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, we have seen, as relatively brief as this season has been so far, we have seen Rowdy Tellez's playing time cut into, and that makes me wonder about what the organization thinks about him and believes about him. My question for you, Shai, is about Danny Jansen, and not because he hasn't hit much in the first week of the season. It's because he hasn't hit much for two full calendar years now. And even when presented with the opportunities to fundamentally perform, whether it was advancing the base runner in the top of the 10th inning on opening day at Yankee Stadium, or with a 3-1 count and nobody out and a runner on second base in the bottom of the 7th last night, he gets a pretty good pitch to hit that he can either inside out to the opposite field to advance the runner, maybe shoot it through the hole, or drive, one of the two, and I have no doubt he was trying to do that. He ends up rolling it over, grounding out to shortstop, and Joe Panik never leaves second base that entire inning. Are we going to get to a point, potentially, where Danny Jansen is Hyunjin Ryu's personal catcher and starts the day games after night games, and Alejandro Kirk gets a bit of a run here as the so-called starting catcher, or is the leash on Jansen still relatively long?
Well, I will say that the answer to that predominantly lies in how much better Alejandro Kirk continues to get defensively. Because if Kirk keeps making gains in terms of his receiving and game calling and communications with pitchers, then he's going to have a real opportunity to force the issue. In the meantime, you know, I'm wary about making too big a deal out of Jansen's offense for a couple reasons. One, you know, I still think that even though it's been across parts of four seasons, we're still dealing with a relatively small sample size. It's, you know, it's essentially one full season's worth of plate appearances for Danny Jansen over his big league career at this point. So, you know, I'm not sure that we should rush to judge. Two, he's always been a good offensive player, and you know, that I still think there's time for him to make some adjustments and to find what he has been in the minor leagues at the plate. And three, I mean, you're talking about a potentially elite defender, you know, someone who does a tremendous job with that pitching staff, you know, really improved his blocking. You can see just the athleticism. He's just a wall back there. He hasn't been really given much of a chance on some of the stolen bases against him. But that's a really strong presence behind the plate. So, you know, Alejandro Kirk has, you know, the Blue Jays definitely emphasize the role of the catcher. You know, they've adapted some things to help out Alejandro Kirk as he makes that transition in their process. But, you know, Kirk has some work to do in that regard. And that has to be the priority. And, you know, with this lineup, the offense out of the catcher spot is a bonus. It's not an essential. You know, it shouldn't matter what Danny Jansen hits because the rest of the lineup should be more than good enough to compensate for that. So, you know, I can definitely see a scenario down the road where that happens, but Kirk has to continue his growth behind the plate for that to really become a possibility.
What's your theory on Rowdy Tellez right now? He looks, I mean, took the walk last night. It was a pretty good at bat, pinch hitting in the bottom of the ninth. But outside of that, there hasn't been anything from him. Do you think he's thinking about his playing time, perhaps dwelling on it? I'd imagine I would be in his scenario, because when George Springer returns, you know, Teoscar, somebody's going to DH. And of course, we've seen Bo and Semi in DH the last 2 days. Like, Rowdy's a first baseman if he's not DHing, and Vladdy ain't coming off that position right now, right? Like, you got to take advantage of your at-bats. He hasn't really done so far.
No, he hasn't. And, you know, and to his credit, Randall Grichuk has, right? And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons we're having this discussion right now. But, you know, one of the drawbacks of having roster surplus is that, you know, the fight for playing time can get into guys' heads. And I could certainly see that being something for Rowdy right now. You know, that disciplined approach where he was really spitting on those borderline pitches and locking in and being able to do damage on his pitches that we saw from him last summer, it just hasn't been there to this point. And, you know, again, we're talking about a week's worth of games, so it's important to not draw too many conclusions from it because, you know, he's certainly got time to correct and time to make adjustments, especially now that George Springer is going to be out a little bit longer than we thought. So that's there. But, you know, the other thing is it's a good thing for the Blue Jays to have options, right? Like you want to have a meritocracy. You want guys to if they're not producing, to have a really good option on the bench. And the Blue Jays have really good options on the bench right now. So, you know, it's a good spot, but it can certainly mess with some guys' heads. That's, you know, the downside to having a lot of depth. And that could certainly be what's going on with Rowdy Flezabet right now.
Mike Trout had himself a game yesterday, and after it, Ross Stripling said, "Trout owns me. He knows it. I know it." Are you a little concerned when one of your starting guys in your rotation says that about a player? Obviously, we know how good Mike Trout is, but...
Well, Mike Trout also owns us. Mike Trout owns everything.
Yeah.
But do you want to hear that out of your starting pitcher, or is this like, no big deal?
No, I mean... You know, I mean, it's basically like a goalie saying, you know, Wayne Gretzky has my number, right? Like, yeah. it was actually interesting because, like, Ross, you know, I was the one who asked Ross about that, and it turns now 7-for-10 in his career against Stripling. So, I mean, the numbers certainly bear it out. But, you know, he had a really good answer for it. He just said, you know, he's a matchup nightmare for me. Right. Like Stripling is a guy who relies on breaking balls down in the zone. And that is what Mike Trout eats for lunch, in Stripling's words. And then, you know, he's vulnerable to velocity up in the zone. And Stripling does not have velocity. You know, as a guy who throws his fastballs like 91, 92. So it's not an ideal matchup for him. Luckily for the Blue Jays, it's not one that, you know, is going to come up regularly. They're not in the same division. They'll play two series against one another. And then if they're going to meet again beyond that, it would be in the playoffs. So, you know, it's not a major issue, but you know, if Mike Trout is getting you, I mean, and you're handling everyone else and, you know, Stripling for the most part did that yet last night. I don't think that's an issue at all.
No, the only defect in the Mickey Mantle cloning was that Mike Trout does not have the ability to switch hit. That's essentially the only thing Mike Trout doesn't do that Mickey Mantle was able to do. I always remind myself every now and then, Shy, I don't think about it all that much, and then it just hits me. Because you know how it doesn't matter what sport you love. Gee, I wish I could have seen Bill Russell play basketball, or gee, I wish I could have watched Gordie Howe, for somebody my age, play hockey. Well, gee, I wish I could have watched Mickey Mantle play baseball. Well, we actually are watching Mickey Mantle play baseball in this day and age in the form of Mike Trout. That's the absolute truth if you compare the stats through the years, through their comparative age years. It's who he is. It's his best comparison.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, him and Ohtani, you've got these two incredible generational talents. And, you know, because they play on the Angels, you know, the lower profile of the LA teams, and they're on the West Coast, and they're not super, super big personalities. They don't go out seeking media. There's not as much appreciation for them as, you know, if these guys were in New York, they'd be massive. right? And I don't know if people grasp that. And, you know, I mean, Stripling, you know, having been with the Dodgers and, you know, playing all those interleague series against the Angels, you know, he would have been up close and personal. And it was kind of funny when he made that comment about Trout last night. I was thinking, you know, remember when Pedro Martinez was having his troubles with the Yankees, and, you know, he just at one point he said, you know, sometimes I'm just gonna, you know, tip my cap and then call them my daddy.
And then Yankees kind of fans, who's your daddy?
That was tremendous stuff. But, you know, you're going to get those matchups in baseball, perhaps more than any other sport, where, you know, you have one guy who inexplicably controls you. But, you know, in this case, it's not like some fringy dude, you know. I mean, it is someone who we're watching, someone on the Hall of Fame trajectory. And someone who by the end of his career could be, you know, up there in a GOAT conversation.
A couple bullet points for you. Shai Davidi with us on Leadoff Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I know you asked Charlie Montoyo about this. What do you know about the degree to which the Blue Jays have been vaccinated?
Not a ton. You know, obviously there's some privacy laws in terms of, you know, who's getting them and who's not, but some players did get some. Charlie Montoyo got his second shot last night, you know, that process is ongoing. So we'll see in the coming days if the Blue Jays are able to get up to that 85% threshold, which would allow them to have some of the protocols removed. But, you know, this is, you know, vaccinations opened up to 18 plus in Florida as of Monday. And, you know, the Blue Jays didn't waste any time upon their return getting to start that process.
Final bullet point for you, league issue. Trevor Bauer of the LA Dodgers. Baseball has confiscated some of the baseballs that he used for his game pitched against the Oakland A's. And apparently there were some scuff marks. There was some stickiness. Trevor Bauer is a weird human being who happens to be an excellent pitcher, but whose spin rate on his fastball jumped considerably about 2.5-3 years ago now, and there has long been speculation that he has been doctoring the baseball. Now, we remember the Clay Buchholz Boston Red Sox stuff in 2013, early in the season here in Toronto, with the bullfrog sunscreen spray that he had on his wrist. His wrist was bright and shiny, etc. This is nothing new in the game, Shai. But baseball wants to clamp down on this. What's fascinating will be, A, what comes of this investigation, and B, if Bauer has to make any adjustments, will it at all mitigate how good a pitcher he is? Because, man, is he on a big ticket.
Yeah, and, you know, remember, too, that, you know, Trevor Bauer is the one who got into a war of words with the Houston Astros, accusing their pitchers of, you know, using sticky stuff to increase their spin rates there, too. And look, the issue I think that will come up is that if, you know, they're just targeting Bauer, or he's the only one that comes out, you know, people will say this is a selective application of rules that have long been ignored for everyone in the game. And, you know, this is, you know, Major League Baseball said we're going to crack down. But are they really cracking down? Because, you know, this occurs everywhere. And, you know, one of the reasons that it's tolerated too, to a certain degree, is that, you know, I think hitters are of the mind, I don't mind that you have better grip on a baseball because you're throwing at 95 plus, and I want you to know where it's going. So, or have a better chance of knowing where it's going rather than it be slippery and you know, flying out of your hand. So, this is, if Major League Baseball is going to really be committed to this, then it's not going to be Trevor Bauer. It's going to be, you know, perhaps a vast majority of pitchers in the game who are going to have to fall in line on this. And they're going to need to have a more consistent application, not this haphazard, you know, we'll pick and choose here and there, which is kind of how they allowed the sign stealing issue to fester for years. And then it ended up blowing up with the Astros scandal.
We'll leave it there, pal. Good to chat. Let's do it again next week or very soon.
Yeah, pleasure as always, guys. Have a great day.
Shai Davidi, Toronto Blue Jays insider, Sportsnet, sportsnet.ca, baseball columnist. Elliot Friedman in just a couple of minutes. Taylor Hall is on the market. We know that. The NHL trade deadline is on Monday. The New York Islanders debuted the shaven, the cleanly shaven Kyle Palmieri last night. Isn't that nice, Siggy? You got this COVID beard, you got this hockey player beard, and you got to go play for Lou Lamoriello's team and shave it off. I guess you'd trade facial hair for a potential shot at a Stanley Cup, though. The question we're going to answer, and Elliot will chime in a little bit after, is what would you be willing to give up for Taylor Hall? And now that the reports are out that Taylor Hall would be willing to sign an extension with the acquiring team, what would that extension look like? Or would you even be interested, just given the way his season has gone and the way things have gone generally over his career, but specifically since the end of his MVP season with the New Jersey Devils? We'll touch on that in a moment. So, Ziggy, Taylor Hall says he'd be willing to sign an extension with a team that acquires him before the trade deadline. And I'm racking my brain last night after I see that report, thinking to myself, because I've advocated, I'd be okay with the Maple Leafs going and getting him. I think it'd be a real nice add to their top nine, another guy who can score goals, and you stick him alongside of John Tavares. I mean, who knows? Who knows what can happen? Maybe he finds his game. But the notion of signing him to a contract extension, and I know it would give the acquiring team a little more certainty. You've got Hall under contract for years to come. You don't risk having him as a rental and then losing him in unrestricted free agency. And if you've got to give up a relatively high draft pick, that becomes more painful and costly if you lose Taylor Hall. I can't imagine what a term on an extension for Taylor Hall would look like. Just given everything, I'd be hesitant to go more than 3 years. And yet here's a guy approaching 30 years old. He's looking to cash in and secure term on one final long-term contract. It'd be a weird negotiation for me if I were on the team side of it.
He's gone to the playoffs twice. If you're looking at Taylor Hall, you're going to be a contender right now, obviously, if you're going to make a move for him. But the guy's gone, this player's gone to the playoffs twice. You want a guy that's won. You'd like a guy that has some experience going deep into the playoffs, and he doesn't have it. I know he's had almost 40 goals and almost 100 points in 17-18, but are you gonna sign Taylor Hall to $8 million over five? Like, are you gonna give him $40 million? Would you give Taylor Hall right now $8 million over a year for 5 years?
My fear, let's use the Buffalo Sabres as an example, a perfect example, the team that he happens to play for. My fear is that you're getting into the Jeff Skinner situation with Taylor Hall, that you end up and it's term as much or more than it is dollar for me, and you get yourself into something that a year and a half in, you're going, oh my God, I wish that hadn't happened.
Well, the whole Skinner thing is a little bit different. The issue with Skinner, and I know it looks like an awful contract right now, the player scored 40 goals. Like, what's the difference whether you sign Skinner for $9 million a year because he came off of a 40-goal season, or you go out and get a guy? I always like the view from a management standpoint is you want to pay the guys on your team, the guys that do it for you the past year, the past couple years, the guys you draft, those are the guys you want to pay. Skinner goes out, scores 40 goals. He was going to get that money from pretty much, there was a handful of teams going to give Skinner that contract he signed. Trust me.
Okay, but there's a difference. There's a difference between that and believing that should happen.
Yeah.
Did you think Jeff Skinner, when you saw that contract land at Jeff Skinner's feet, 8-72, did you not go, I'm not so sure about that? Like, that's when it's not hindsight, right? For me, like, when I saw that contract, and Jeff Skinner was a first-round draft pick, really nice young player with Carolina, had some concussion issues, obviously is a goal scorer, certainly put up good numbers in a contract year, deserves all the credit in the world. But you didn't have any red flags about that deal when you saw that it was signed?
Well, he's had 37, 33, 28. Like, yeah. He's put up goal. He's had years where he's scored a lot. Did I think he was going to be able to keep up 40 goals a year? No. And if you don't think he can keep up 40 goals, then sure, don't give him the money. But he was getting that money regardless. That's the thing. And if you're sitting there in Buffalo, you're saying, we want a 40-goal guy. who are we going to go and get? We have a guy here. We can lock him up. Why not get Jeff Skinner? I at the time when he signed, when anytime a player signs a long-term deal like this, there's always part of me where I'm like, you know this, you know the end of this contract isn't going to work out. Now from looking at it, the start of this contract isn't going to work out. You're hoping the end of it works out. But back to Taylor Hall, if Taylor Hall is looking for $8 million a year, I don't see him in a sign and trade this year where he goes somewhere to a contender and they lock him up. It's not happening.
I don't see him as a Leaf. I don't see him as a Leaf because in that scenario, Ziggy, if and this is all hypothetical, if you bring Taylor Hall here and you give him some degree of term at that dollar amount, Zach Hyman's gone. Like Zach Hyman's out the door at the end of the year.
Zach Hyman's gone regardless.
You think he's gone?
There's no chance he's coming unless this is the last year for the Big Four. Like if this is the last shot, okay, I'll give it a 50-50. But if they're bringing back the Big Four, there's no way Hyman's coming back. He's not resigning. He's not going to resign here. Not happening. I know it's brutal to hear. And those are just the facts of the situation. Where the cap is at with the Leafs. How are you going to bring you're going to sign Hyman right now to $5.5 million with the Big Four at 40. So you're going to have $46 million tied up in five forwards.
Right. And then, and the problem is that you'd probably have to move a Kerfoot to get his salary off the books. And then you're looking at $700,000 centerman in your third and fourth lines. It's complicating, man. There's no question about that.
Well, even Taylor Hall, you bring Taylor Hall in at $8 million, Buffalo will eat half the salary. What $4 million's coming off the books? Like, who are we getting rid of? That's the other part of it. And that's with Buffalo eating half the salary. And if they're asking if the Leafs trade a first rounder for Hall, I think it would, I don't like the way this is going to turn out.
You'd better win the Stanley Cup if you do that. And you can't know that when you make the deal.
Yeah. Right. I don't even know if I'd give up a second. I don't like the Hall fit. And I know he's been the name thrown around a lot and he's available, but I don't know. Right now, that's not Paul Mary is the guy was up there for me. I think Miles Wood, I'm not sure they're going to want to get rid of him now in New Jersey, but there's Boone Jenner. Apparently his wrist is bad or he hurt his hand blocking a shot. So
maybe a Foligno, you know,
he's out. Foligno's an okay option for me, but I'm not sold on Taylor Hall coming to the Leafs. I'm making them better. I think they're good. I think the Leafs have a good thing going right now. I really do. I think this is, I like the makeup. You just wouldn't mind one more guy with some, you just wouldn't like a Mikheyev with some finish and I'd be happy, but you know, he's slowly finding his offensive game, but a guy like that, or a guy with a little bit of, you know, a little bit of sandpaper to his game.
Jack Campbell will join Tim and Friends later on this evening.
Nice.
On Sportsnet 590, awesome. The Fan. You can watch on Sportsnet 360. Leafs back in action tomorrow against the Ottawa Senators on Hockey Night in Canada. And speaking of HNIC, Elliot Friedman will join us in just a moment to pick up on this conversation. But here's what we're talking about this morning on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. The Blue Jays lose their home opener, their ninth in their last 10 home openers. They've lost three in a row overall, fall to 3-4, a 7-5, 11-inning loss to Mike Trout and the Los Angeles Angels. Trout had a huge night last night. A triple shy of the cycle, 3-for-5 with a couple of runs scored and an RBI. The Maple Leafs back in action tomorrow night, home to the Ottawa Senators. And we should remind you that the NHL trade deadline is 3 days away, Monday afternoon. So be watching Sportsnet, be listening to Sportsnet 590 The Fan all weekend, and especially on Monday for all of your trade deadline coverage. And the Raptors are in deep now. They fall to the Chicago Bulls last night, badly undermanned. Just had 8 players available. The Raps are 3 games back of the 10th place Bulls for that final play-in tournament spot. And the Bulls won the season series, which means they also have the tiebreaker over the Raptors. The math is getting ugly for Toronto. Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada, the NHL on Sportsnet, and 31 Thoughts, both the podcast and the weekly column on sportsnet.ca, is with us now. And he is brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit donvalleynorthlexus.com. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
All right, let's get right to business here. We're about 72 hours away, a little more, to the NHL trade deadline. What are you hearing right now about Kyle Dubas's pursuit of a player or two?
I think that there's a lot of people waiting a lot of other people out. There was the one trade obviously the other day between the Islanders and the Devils. I think the Devils took a look at the market. They said, we want to try to get a first round pick. They told everybody who called them on Paul Mary, their goal was a first round pick. And, you know, they did everything they could to get one. They took 50% of two contracts. They took a couple prospects who don't have high ceilings. And they put two players in the deal and they got their pick. And the moment they realized they could get it, they decided to make the deal. I think Lou Lamoriello was kind of working his way between New Jersey and Buffalo. It was going to be either Hall or it was going to be Paul Mary. And once he got the deal he was happy with, he said, I think the Devils knew that once he said, okay, we're going to do this with the first, they kind of said, we better do it because we know he's got another option. So once Paul Mary was off the board, I think the dance began again with players like Hall and everyone else. So I think, there's a few teams here that are buyers who are kind of looking at this and saying, you better realize if you want that kind of a return, there's a lot you're going to have to do to help yourself out. So I think the poker game continues.
Is Hall worth a first rounder to you?
I said this a couple weeks ago that I said it was going to be hard for them to get a first rounder for Hall, Mike, and it turned into this, why are you insulting Taylor Hall? It's not that. It's just that I think it's going to be hard to get a first rounder for him. You need a bit of a bidding war. And you need to be willing to do things. Look what the Devils did to get a first rounder. They made a lot of concessions and it got them what they wanted. And, you know, that's probably what's going to have to happen too for Buffalo.
The thing with Taylor Hall, it's interesting. The reports come out that he'd be willing to sign an extension with an acquiring team here, Elliot.
Yeah.
Well, of course he would, you know, because the 1 year deal.
Well, not always. Some guys like to test their market.
Well, okay, and I suppose a good stretch run and then a good playoff performance would amp up his value. But, I mean, the one-year experiment in Buffalo was essentially to set himself up to cash in on what arguably, from a term perspective, would be his last big contract as he approaches 30 years old. So I suppose he's willing to mitigate the acquiring team's risk of a rental by discussing and perhaps signing an extension. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder what worry an acquiring team would have over giving Taylor Hall term. I mean, he's a few years removed from his MVP in New Jersey, and let's mm-hmm. be honest, it hasn't been pretty lately.
No, it hasn't. But, you know, I think the reason that Hall is letting it be known he would consider term is that it probably gives you a bit of a better chance of getting a better return for him.
Yeah.
That's what this is about.
Yeah.
And
helping the Sabres.
Yes. And the other thing too is one of the teams I'm trying to get a handle here is Boston. I've heard different things about the Bruins' willingness to do a rental. You know, they had a big win last night. They're in fourth place in their division. Rask is hurt, although he's now with the team. The young guy who won last night, who beat the Capitals, Swayman, Jeremy Swayman, he's a good prospect. But I think, you know, the Bruins are looking at this and saying, if Rask isn't really able to play for them, can we win this year? Like, how much of an asset are the Bruins willing to give up for a rental? And I get conflicting answers on that. I've had some people tell me the Bruins really aren't crazy about the whole rental idea for this year. So what that says to me is that, you know, I look at when I heard the reports and CJ had one last night about Hall willing to take an extension, the team that I thought of immediately was the Bruins, because I could see that appealing more to them than just about anybody else. So, I mean, I could be totally making this up, but that's what I thought about.
Who are some of the other names right now that you think the Leafs could go after, or you'd want them to go after?
Or Scotty wants them to go. You better ask Scott this question. He's more invested in it than anyone else. Like, I should say this about Hall. I'm not convinced Toronto was there on him. The one thing I could see is that, you know, like I said, it's a big poker game right now, and the Islanders and Devils, and I think the Sabres kind of at the same time, had their poker game, and that game's over. And now, you know, now we're on to the next ones. Like, the thing about Hall is, I didn't get the sense, like, there was a time on Wednesday, where, you know, the Islanders had a shot at getting Hall. And there, when he was taken out of that game Tuesday night, I think we had a sense it was close. I didn't get the sense at that time that Toronto was one of the teams. And so I think when it comes to Toronto and Hall, I think that it's probably a situation where they're looking at it and saying, okay, if we do this, it's because the price is right for us. So I'm not convinced that they're one of the front runners on him as we say this right now. Maybe that'll change throughout the weekend, but I'm not convinced it at 8 o'clock on Friday morning. Now, other guys we're looking at here, at forward, there's Foligno, from Columbus, which lost again last night. You know, who else are we looking at here? I think he's one of the guys that people are kind of speculating with Toronto. Other guys that we're kind of looking at, I'm trying to think if there's any particular names that really jump out.
Is there a Raquel in Anaheim? I mean, he could get moved, but maybe the Leafs aren't in.
I don't know.
How about Miles Wood, Ziggy says, out of Jersey?
Yeah, you know, like here's the thing with guys like Wood and Raquel. We know that the Maple Leafs have a tricky negotiation coming up with Zach Hyman. If you get a guy with term, are you not boxing yourselves out of him?
Well, that's what I've been arguing. Ziggy, you tell me. I mean, yeah. We debated this before you came on, Elliot. Ziggy doesn't think Hyman's coming back under any circumstance because they just can't make it fit.
Know. Well, I don't know about that. I
think they've got to try to make it fit.
Well, I think they will. Like the whole Hyman thing reminds me of Jake Gardner. Okay, so Jake Gardner, when he left Toronto, they tried everything to keep him. Okay, they really liked Gardner as a person. They thought he was a guy who took a lot of pride in being a Maple Leaf. They tried different structures. They just couldn't make it work. Okay. And I think they're going to try the same thing with Hyman. And no offense to Gardner, I think that the will to keep Hyman is even greater than now than the will to keep Gardner at the time. Like, I think they're really going to try. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be Hyman's decision. He's the UFA. But I think they will do everything they can to keep him, per the cap. I don't necessarily it's going to be up to him in the sense of how much of a discount is he going to be willing to take to stay in Toronto. I don't know the answer to that. Only Zach Hyman can decide that. You're right. He could do better somewhere else. At the end of the day, it's going to come down to what he's willing to leave on the table to stay here. But I know this, if you get a Raquel or you get a Wood, and those are two really good players, I'm just looking at what that means on the cap next year, and I'm saying, aren't you punting on Hyman if you're doing that?
Well, yeah. And he knows that the moment the player's acquired as well. Like, he knows that he's into his final couple of months as a Maple Leaf for sure. So I think,
I could be wrong. It's happened before, but I think the Leafs are looking at rentals. So I look at So I'm not as convinced it's going to be a Raquel or a Wood. So I'm looking at the rentals. I'm looking at Foligno. I go back and forth every 10 minutes on Hall. So those are the kinds of guys I'm looking at. And I, you know what? I also think I've also wondered about Oleksiak from Dallas. Again, it's another one I kind of hear in and out. I think there's quite a bit of interest in him. You know, the Stars won again last night. You know, the math, it's not an easy road for them with all the games they have, but they're still in it, right? But I've wondered if Toronto would consider doing something like that. I think a team like Colorado is also potentially there on Oleksiak, and I'm sure they're not the only ones. He had such a good playoff last year that I could see somebody trying it if Colorado decides to make that move.
Elliot Friedman with us on Leadoff Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I don't want you thinking that I'm so tunnel visioned that I don't notice other teams, Elliot. So
I don't. Well, you're what city are you on in?
Well, I mean, I'm telling you right now, I'm more concerned about these two teams because they happen to play the Leafs a lot.
Yeah,
Gallagher in Montreal, Wheeler in Winnipeg. Those injuries, what, if anything, does that do to Mark Bergevin's and Kevin Cheveldayoff's MOs come Monday or before?
Well, I mean, Wheeler, they said they're potentially dealing with a concussion, or they're treating as if it's a concussion, right? So who knows? I mean, you just hope he's okay. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen. You know, I don't think it really changes much about their approach unless they suddenly feel that this is something they're not going to get him back from. We know he's another guy who's sitting there looking at the D and saying, okay, I'm going to pick one of these guys here and let's wait until the price goes down a little bit. So that's Winnipeg. Montreal, I mean, he could do anything. I think he's looking for a defenseman. I do. I think he's looking for someone who's like, I think he really liked the idea of Ekholm, although I don't believe that's going to happen, but I could see him going for another blue liner and trying to do that. A left-hand shot. So you actually know what, he could even do a righty. It depends on what he wants to do back there, but I could see Bergevin, like, you know, they've been flat for all the changes they've made. You know, they've lost two in a row without Gallagher, and they didn't play too badly in Toronto. I wasn't crazy about their game last night. I could see Bergevin doing something.
Leafs goalie situation with Campbell and Anderson, and even all of the, you know, the crowd that said, I don't care how good Campbell plays, it's Anderson's net when he comes back. Even that crowd is now saying Anderson is on a short leash. It's not even his net. Have you changed your point of view on the goalie situation in Toronto?
Well, it's just that, Mike, like right now it is Campbell's goal, right? If Anderson came back tomorrow, who's the starter?
I'm running with Campbell right now, but I...
Well, of course.
I'm
surprised it took you that long to answer. I was like, hey, is this
I don't,
on?
I, like, No. I still think it's... I still don't... I'm still not sold as Campbell as the full-time starter. Like, I wouldn't write Anderson off this season just yet. I'm not part of the it's all Campbell now. It's in his hands. Freddie has to earn back the net. I'm not there yet. I haven't gone that far over the line.
This segment is called Everybody Loves Jack Campbell Except Manus. You know, I am
conveniently staying quiet and enjoying this. My feet are up.
And that's fair. Like, I don't have a big problem with that. Ziggy, I'm just saying that right now it's Campbell's net. If Anderson was to come back healthy, I don't think it would matter. Now, you know, I think the whole Anderson thing, I've really tried to work at it this week, and my what I sense is he's not going to be back on the ice by Monday, but, you know, both he and the Maple Leafs believe he will be back this year. They have more information on him than anyone else does. You know, I think it's up to Toronto to decide how comfortable they are with the idea. I think that's what it comes down to. You know, Dubas has let other teams know, you know, he has looked around at the goalie market. He, you know, one of the things he's asked is, you know, one of the things he's told teams is, I'm not doing a goalie unless I feel I absolutely have to. So that's kind of where we are. They believe he's going to play. Apparently, Anderson believes he's going to play. I think what happened, Mike, is that when Campbell was hurt, Anderson played when he wasn't healthy. Mm. And, you know, I think that now that Campbell's back and he's on a run, that the team and Anderson have decided he's not going to play until he's healthy. And they don't believe he's out for the year. And the other thing, too, is, like, I've had people say to me, why don't you just put the guy on LTIR so you can get more cap room and then you can activate him for the playoffs? I think that's a – I think you can do that with Nikita Kucherov, and I think you can do that with Brendan Gallagher. If I had Stanley Cup aspirations, I don't know if I'd do that with my 1A goalie.
Hmm. We will leave it there, pal, and appreciate your time, as we always do. We'll be watching tomorrow night, especially in the first intermission or the second intermission when you lay it all out. And we will talk to you on Monday morning.
Yes, I hear I've been conscripted into a second hit. Mike Gentile sent me a note last night. Hey, thanks for joining us again Monday morning at 8. I was like, I am?
I am?
We had a meeting and we put you in. I was like, all right, trade deadline's already off to a great start.
Yeah, and you know Silk Gentile. I mean, he's going to present it to you like you made the decision.
Yes,
and it's
thank you
wonderful.
Very much for helping us. Yes.
You've been voluntold.
And I not only did that, I've got 9 Bitcoin from Gentile that only he has the key to in the same conversation.
All right. And that's about where it stops for me. I'm late to the Bitcoin game. That's all I know.
Ask CJ next time you talk to him.
You got it. Lots of fun, pal. Right. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
Elliot Friedman, brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit Don Valley North Lexus. .com. We are making the effort to dial up former Blue Jays first base coach Tim Leeper here. We want to go with Leep. What do you think's on his mind this morning?
You think
he wants to talk Conforto leaning into that pitch?
We'll talk about that.
Trevor Bauer in the 2016 playoffs with Cleveland. Remember, the Blue Jays did.
We'll talk about the baseballs. I want to talk to him about Davis at first base, if that's the first base coach's fault. If that he got picked off at first, is that not the first base coach? Like, do we need to get someone else in there?
Blame the stopwatch holder?
What other job do you have? Make sure the guy doesn't get picked off at first. That's your only job.
Friday, April 9th, 2021, the day that Mike Zigomanis turned on Mark Budzinski. It's Zigomanis versus Budzinski, steel cage. It's WrestleMania weekend. I think we have our new main event. Well, here he is, Tim Leeper. Ziggy, you ask that question. You lay it out for the guy who used to hold the stopwatch.
Leap Davis gets picked off at first. I'm sorry, but as a first base coach, what is your job? And how many times have you had guys picked off at your base?
It's the same as when you're out there and your defensive coach, you miss an assignment and they score a goal and you get a minus in the book. You can't be hard on the first base coach. Our job as a first base coach is to be proactive. So you do all your work before the game. You get guys prepared. You do those things. The human being takes over in that situation. And Mark Budzinski's a good guy. He should not be taking any heat because you know what? And short of just putting a rope on a guy and keeping him there, like you have to go on the player. Like he's taught well. And he should know better than that in this situation. That was bad. And one of the things for Jonathan Davis, I mean, and this is, he came up obviously when I was there and he came up through the system. I was there from the first day. The biggest things he has to do to stay in the big leagues is number one, play great defense. He can't waver there. He has to be great at that. He has to be able to hit left-handed pitching and he has to be able to run the bases and be dependable whenever he goes in. So that kind of falls on him. And, you know, there's a situation the other night too, where he stole third base with two outs and got thrown out and those things aren't good. So it's up to him to tighten it up. It's not that anyone's not telling him because I know they're prepared and I know they do a good job, but that being as a first base coach and hearing the fans yell at you in those situations, it absolutely sucks.
With Tim Leeper and Leap, I mean, I can live with Davis getting thrown out trying to steal second. That's what he's there for. With two outs, you're trying to move into scoring position for Semien so that a base hit to the outfield wins you the baseball game. But you can't be picked off. By the way, Louis Rivera was red-assed after that. We didn't see it so much on camera, but he thought Cishek was balking.
A very good point.
Like, I'm confused. I'm confused about this step-off thing. I haven't noticed a whole lot of change into how right-handed pitchers throw over to first base this year. I know they're supposed to legitimately and very clearly step off the mound before they do that now. I haven't noticed a big difference. Have you, number one and number two, did you think that was a balk?
Well, the rule is only good for the A-ball league, so they haven't actually changed the rule in the big leagues. They're experimenting with it in the lower minor leagues to see if they can take that to the big leagues.
Okay.
And what guys do in those situations, and C6 big, and he's a guy that played for me, and him and Tommy Kohler, we were on the same team, and Tommy Kohler had one of the best balk moves in baseball. And this is one of the reasons that I get thrown out of games by us, is that C6 tall, and when you break your knees, like just kind of bend your knees, that should be a signal that you're starting your delivery and you're going to home plate. What a pitcher does to deceive the runner is gives that little knee bend and then stops and spins. So again, I can give JD the benefit of the doubt on this one. And I know, like at Cishek and Kohler, I'm blowing them up right now. They live close to each other, but this is something they worked on, and there's a lot of deception with that too. So why it maybe looked really bad, I mean, that's part of the reason why he was close to the base and didn't even get off, because the move is really, really good. So umpires are not consistent calling that thing. I remember standing over there at the first baseline a lot of times and asking the umpire, especially with the guys with good balk moves like this, like, tell me when his delivery starts, because I want to be able to tell my runner when to go. So I would say to the umpire, hey, if this guy breaks his knees right here, is that the start of his delivery? And then 9 times out of 10, I didn't get an answer. There was gray area there, and then it just got left open to their interpretation at the time. And I think that could be the case last night.
Yeah, because usually the controversy over balk, no balk is with the left-hander, right? Who is his right leg, his lift leg, breaking the plane of the mound, and if it is, that's a balk if he goes over to first, because that's supposed to signal that he's going to the plate, all of that stuff. It's less common with the right-hander.
There are guys that are really deceptive and good with it. There's a lot of times too, like a right-handed pitcher will just kind of leak his left shoulder in towards the third baseman and then give a pick. And those guys are dangerous too. And again, it's deliberate. It's guys with advanced, you know, have advanced talent in this area, and it's part of their game. And like, again, that's why when you know you have those guys, it's important to go like, set it up with the umpire before the game. I did that quite a bit with guys. And again, umpires didn't, I love the umpires, don't get me wrong here, but there's a lot of times they didn't want to like have that conversation just because they didn't want to be put on the spot.
With Tim Leeper on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. So Ziggy and I have been throwing out opinions all morning on the handling of extra innings when you start with the runner on second. So I will shelve that and just throw it to you in the form of a question. If you are the visiting team, does your approach to the start of an extra inning at bat with a runner on second differ than if you are the home team? Like, you know, the Blue Jays last night, Leap, have a chance with a runner on second and nobody out in the bottom of the 10th to win the baseball game, right? Because they kept the Angels off the board in the top of the 10th.
Mm-hmm.
From a fundamental perspective, what is it as a coach or a manager, what is it you want to see? How do you want to see an offensive team approach an inning like that with a chance to win and a guy in scoring position, nobody out?
In theory, like if you're the home team in that situation, you have a chance to win, like you think you just bunt the guy to third and get him over because you have either a ground ball or a fly ball and get the guy in. I've done this rule in international baseball. I haven't managed this in the big leagues, obviously. But I would say that in the theory kind of goes out the window right now, and you're dealing with personnel more than anything. You have to take into account who's on the pitcher's mound. Like these guys, if it's a really good reliever that throws 97, 98 with tons of movement, guess what? People, bunting is really, really hard. It's not easy to do. And so like if you have a guy who's not a great bunter and it's harder to do than you think, and you have a guy who's got really good stuff on the mound, you stand a much better chance of swinging the bat. Like I know, you know, Jansen was put in a tough situation a couple days ago where he was trying to bunt a guy over in extra innings. Well, the guy had really good stuff, and Danny had to try three times. In that situation, I don't think you're setting the player up for success if you don't let him swing the bat. So it's, to me, it's who's on the mound. Is he throwing pitches over the plate that are easy to bunt? And do I have a guy who can really handle the bat in that situation, who can really bunt and get the ball down? You know, you also have to take into account, like, the defense. Like, if Marcus Stroman's on the mound, he's a really good athlete. Any bunt that gets down in his vicinity, there's a really good chance he's going to get the lead runner. If Evan Longoria is at third base and you put a bunt in his hands, there's a good chance the lead runner is going to be out. So it depends on so many variables. And it's just not the pitcher. It's just not the hitter. It's who's on the mound in terms of how he plays defense, who's at the corners. And I think you have to take it as an individual situation that way. And I think one thing this rule has shown, that there's really no right approach to it. I mean, the team that executes is the team that wins, and that's one of the reasons why I kind of like the rule.
We love waking you up bright and early. You're out in Arizona. It's like 5:30 in the morning right now.
Is it still? Oh,
we just
2 hours back, 3 hours back,
3 hours back as we move forward. Right,
5:30. Wow.
Jens was great to me too, because he did ask me if I wanted to go on earlier. It would have been 3:15, but I was ready. I was ready for it. I would have been more ornery, but it was good. I had Elliot stopping me up here. So.
I mean, you know, we got three games. We got tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday. I think you should come on bright and early Monday morning for a full breakdown of three games worth of Blue Jays baseball. I think it would be rude of you to not agree to that.
You know what though? It's spring training, and it's funny, I'm responsible for like 25 guys in the outfield, and so there's scheduling and it's a mess and all that stuff. So, but like, I'm such an idiot and I'm such a baseball guy and such a baseball coach. I wake up at 3 o'clock worrying that the day is going to be all right. So I'm up anyway.
How can a guy who can't even be responsible for himself be responsible for 25 other young lives who are trying to make it in the big leagues?
Don't tell anybody.
Oh, shoot. I said the
greatest
part
scam
out loud.
I got going. You're ruining it.
All right, pal. Thanks for doing this. And you know, we'll be calling on you next week. Always fun.
All right. Good talking, guys. Have a great weekend.
Tim Leeper doing some work with the minor leaguers of the San Francisco Giants out there in Arizona. Former first base and outfield coach for the Toronto Blue Jays. The great Christine Brennan of USA Today. She is at Augusta National on the tournament and on the goings-on surrounding the tournament in the state of Georgia. Christine is next. Be Justin Rose's year, Ziggy. You can quickly know that one. No, you're not a believer. Not a believer.
He's got what did Savvy say? Lead. Top eight. I said he doesn't even get in the top 10. So I'll take that bet, Savvy. We'll do a double or nothing. All right. So two chicken dinners from Swiss Chalet. Is that what we're doing?
And you and I'll do a Swiss Chalet thing. I'll say Hyman is back. Are you gonna? Okay. Are you gonna firm and say Hyman's Gonzo? Okay.
Yes, there is a couple conditions to him staying, for me, and that's if the big four come back.
Okay. And I'm not going to ban you. If you have to buy me dinner at Swiss, it's the salad with Chalet dressing. There's no better salad dressing in the world than Chalet house dressing. Come at me. You're wrong. And a half with fries. That's where I'm going.
So if you just order a soup and salad, that's the dinner.
And that's the banya. Yeah. Be make it Mendy's. Christine Brennan is listening to all of this and probably regretting that she is on the phone, waiting to come on with us right now. Here she is, the great Christine Brennan of USA Today. We appreciate your time this morning. We won't get into a debate over soup and salad with you, Christine. So let's get right to it. I mean, you have covered everything. Multiple Olympics. You've been all over the world. Augusta National, the Masters. Where do you put this tournament on the list of events you have covered throughout your career?
Well, first of all, great to be with you, Scott and Ziggy, and I pick salad for sure. But
is salad a meal? No, we're not going to debate that. We're not getting into Seinfeld on that one.
All the time. Here, because I'm not going to go into restaurants in Georgia where, even though it's blue politically, you know, by a sliver, the lack of masking is extraordinary. So I'm eating a lot of the chef salad and the club salads, whatever, from the club for my meal. So trust me on that. They have wonderful food here. And so lots of salads as full meals. You know, this is right up there for sure. I mean, the Olympics is different, as you guys know well, because it's a movable feast. You know, it literally goes one place and then it moves on. So every Olympics I've been to, and I've been so lucky and fortunate to cover every single one, summer and winter since LA in 84. I'll be in Tokyo this summer. Should be fascinating. So difficult, so sad, so many ways that it's not going to be what we would expect it to be, but it's still going to be an amazing news story, whatever happens. In these very difficult times. That's different. The closest I can compare would be Wimbledon in terms of that set location, a fixed point every year that we go back to, and or that the sports world goes back to if I'm not physically there, which I'm Wimbledon, I've been to 7 or 8 maybe, which is wonderful. And here I've done 20 maybe, but they certainly can go on without me. But the same look, green, you know, Wimbledon throws in purple as well, but just that old school look of Fenway Park, the Green Monster, Wrigley Field, those very, very few venues we have now in North America, in the world, frankly, that stand the test of time, and that you can stand somewhere and say back in the 1940s or 50s, so-and-so was right here on this spot, which I think is just so cool. And so, yes, the traditions, good and bad, it's a different time when you come in the gates here. It's the 1950s or 1960s in terms of prices of prices of the food, the $1.50 sandwich, the dollar, you know, apple slices, the $2 Diet Coke. You don't see that anywhere else, and that's admirable. And then, of course, with old school tradition, you certainly get some old school thinking as well. And that's certainly something I've been writing and talking about over the last couple decades.
Fred Ridley, the Augusta National chairman and company, probably didn't like the fact that Dustin Johnson went 20 under in November. And we've seen this in past years, right? Whenever there's a, you know, a blowout victory, we had Jordan Spieth with, 18 under in 2015. You come back the next year, -5 wins it. Tiger Woods, he finished with 18 under. The following year is -9. So far in the first round, we've had, it's 220 over par versus 54 under par in November. Is that something you think Augusta really wanted to tighten the screws on the players and make this a lot tougher and not have what we had in November?
I do think that, yes. I think they definitely don't want this to look like a pitch and putt. And, you know, but they also don't want it to be the U.S. Open either, right? Because the U.S. Open often can be won by someone right around par, even over par, I think, has won the U.S. Open. Certainly, over par scores are not unusual when you're hacking it out from knee-deep rough. That doesn't happen here. I wrote the word rough a time, or once, at least I think once, in my Dustin Johnson column last night as I followed up on, you know, his next round after 5 months of having the green jacket. I use the word rough, and you know, quote unquote rough, because it truly is. If your backyard, you'd be thrilled to have your backyard look like the rough here. But I think the difference, the big difference, everyone was talking about it all week. I was out there on Sunday, and Kevin Na was being asked, actually, by Gene Wojciechowski of ESPN, who I was chatting with, a dear friend for, 35 years, whatever. And he said, so much firmer. Firmer, just so much firmer than it was in November. So I think that's part of the issue. They're keeping, obviously, it's been dry. That's going to change. There could be some rain later this afternoon and some rain definitely Saturday. But it has been dry. It has been sunny.
Very low humidity for Georgia this time of year. Lovely weather, just spectacular weather, you know, 60s, 70s, just, you know, you die for that. And but that made the golf course get harder and firmer. And so that's what you saw with Dustin Johnson. I think there were five, six times he could not hold the green, you know, with an iron, whether it was off the tee on 16 or 6 or you know, his approach on the par fours or par fives, he just couldn't do it. And so the ball's trickling off, and then he's chipping. And whereas he was able to just throw darts, as they all were, just and land them so easily back in November, and that was because the golf course was softer. So I think part of it was November, just a different time. It's the one and only November Masters. We certainly hope, knock on wood, that we're getting out of all this and that we're going to come back to some sense of normalcy. And that the Masters was part of that pandemic conversation in this way, that November gave us a very different, quirky Masters, but it gave us a champion who was deserved. In other words, it wasn't some guy that just, you know, drove in out of the parking lot or came in out of the parking lot and said, hey, I'm here. It was one of the great players of this generation, Dustin Johnson. So that's good news. The fact he was able to go 20 under, wow, right? It broke all kinds of scoring records. That will be remembered. I'm going to guess we might have a little asterisk in our minds about the November 2020 Masters. That doesn't mean Dustin Johnson didn't deserve it. Of course he did. He is so fitting as a winner, a major champion. But it does mean that it will always be seen as a little bit different.
Christine Brennan with us of USA Today. She's at the Masters, Augusta National. This is Lead Off, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So you wrote a column, and essentially the headline is why it's time for Bryson DeChambeau to win his first Masters. Based on his Thursday round, the response at this point would be Bryson DeChambeau, no. He's very much, Christine, that guy. And that guy can be anything, but he's fundamentally changing the sport or contributing to the change of the sport. He is someone who thinks differently about the sport and who expresses that. I would imagine he rubs some people the wrong way. I don't think that's a secret. What do you make of Bryson DeChambeau, the aura around him, the 400-foot or near 400-foot drives, just the whole package that is Bryson?
I think he's great. I think the mad scientist, you know, scientific experiment stuff, going down the rabbit holes, as he said here the other day in a press conference that I was in, you know, it's fun. Golf has a big demographic problem. And that's really not our problem. It might be some of the listeners' problems going forward, but it, you know, but I do enjoy chronicling all kinds of social and cultural things in sports. And this is one of them for golf. And I played the game my whole life. Our dad wanted to make sure his three daughters, as well as his son, learned to play golf and felt comfortable on a golf course. He was a girl dad before we had such things as girl dads. He was, you know, 30 years ahead of his time. And so I play golf, and I played four or five times, actually, even during the winter, nine holes, you know, when it was okay weather in Washington, D.C., where I'm based. So I don't hate golf. I like golf very much. I think it's a great game. I think it's got a huge problem in terms of demographics, and it has basically put out the stop sign for girls and women for a long time, too long, and is now scrambling. The women's amateur is an example, Augusta National trying to kind of make up for lost time on this as a leader in the sport. But, you know, girls and women, most of them I know who are athletes aren't playing golf and maybe are lost forever. And yet they will play sports the rest of their lives and have disposable income. What a huge, huge, huge mistake the game of golf has made on women. Certainly minorities. Tiger has no coattails, right? Maybe, I don't know. I mean, Cameron Champ is biracial. But it is just so rare to see a person of color making the tour, either tour, the women's or the men's. Wow. Huge issues. Because white men alone just can't sustain this. Older white men can't sustain this game, even though we love them. But in 50 years, what's golf going to look like? Coming back to Bryson DeChambeau, obviously a white male in his 20s. But he is the kind of guy that a kid who plays video games, boy or girl, somebody who's into physics and science, who would never turn on the TV to watch golf, might go, hey, that guy that's talking about swing speed and ball speed and doing all that crazy stuff and getting all these tests done on himself. You know, maybe someone who wants to be a doctor someday, some kid. I'm talking about kids, the future fans of golf. Golf needs them desperately. They need them to buy products and buy rounds of golf, golf balls, you know, et cetera, golf clubs. Bryson's the kind of guy that can attract a younger audience. Golf desperately needs him to succeed. Who cares what the other golfers think of him, because the game of golf, it's got real trouble moving forward if it doesn't lighten up and if it doesn't get younger and certainly less white and more and less male. And so, you know, Bryson's that kind of guy that can bring some interesting looks to the sport. They need it. He also, though, I think puts so much pressure on himself and starts overthinking everything and talks so much that he gets out here as he did yesterday and just looks like a mess. So much for that prediction about Bryson winning.
Oh, who knows? Who knows? Maybe he picks it back up starting today. Christine, we're right up against the clock at the end of the show, so we'll thank you very much for your time and look forward to talking again in the not-too-distant future. Have a wonderful weekend at Augusta. It's the best.
Oh, you too. Thanks so much, guys. Really enjoyed it. Take care.
Christine Brennan of USA Today. Elliot Friedman, John Paul Morosi, Stephen Brunt. We'll do a little baseball. The Jays have three games between now and our next show. NHL trade deadline on Monday. Have an awesome weekend. We'll talk to you Monday morning at 6 o'clock. Good show is next.
Nice work, everyone. Sharp broadcast. Really good. Everyone on the floor as well. Really a lot of hustle. I liked it.